Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, welcome back to another edition of Leaving the Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas, with my co-host, Gabriel Montoya, and we're here to talk some boxing. A lot of stuff to catch up with and speak about. We got some good fights coming up. A lot of folks are already calling it Fight of the Year, Brandon Rios and Mike Alvarado, and obviously we got Nonito Dornier. That's Gabriel over there trying to get his headset on, so that's why you hear all that noise in the background.
Sorry about that.
One time I don't mute myself. Hilarious.
Exactly, you know. But a lot of things to talk about. We got some past weekend. Linares is back in action. He was in a tough little gritty fight, and we'll get a little bit into that. Then Timothy Bradley announced he's not going to face Lamont Peterson December 15th. But then we got a really good fight, man, that I'm really excited about, which is Adrian Broner versus Antonio DeMarco. I didn't think he was going to take that fight. Didn't think he was willing to jump up and face a hard-punching Mexican fighter like that. I thought he was going to try to avoid him. We've seen him try to avoid other fighters or kind of, you know, just weasel his way out of certain things or get the advantages, you know. I mean, he's really kind of shown that he believes that he's that superstar. He believes that he has that draw power for him to make those, adjustments of doing things his way. Even with Al Haymon apologizing for the last time when he has got in the ring with Vicente Escobedo coming in as a welterweight, we all know the outcome of that fight there. But, Al Haymon apologizing about the unprofessionalism of Adrian Broner. I don't know if you remember that, Gabriel.
Yeah. I'm actually researching this Tim Bradley thing. I didn't realize, I'm not sure that it is exactly what people think it is. It looks like it's a story that's been, you know, the Desert Sun covers it, and that guy covers him fairly often, and seems to have kind of an in with him. His name is Leighton Gin or Jin, and Boxing Scene kind of grabbed it and ran with it. Well, Boxing Scene also talked to him. It's hard to tell. You know Tim better than I do. We have more of a relationship there. Do you think this has all just gone to his head and he's outpricing himself? Or do you agree with him that he's saying, I've already been down the Peterson road. I don't really need to do that again. I'm with Tim, actually. I've been a supporter of Provodnikov. I think that's a fight that could happen and would be a fun fight at least.
You know, with the announcement and same thing here, we haven't got our full investigation on. I haven't even hit up Timothy Bradley about it. But I think it may come down to a money issue. I mean, I think it's a little bit of two. One is been down that road. Two is if I'm going to go back down that road, I need to get paid for it. He gets off one of the biggest fights of his career with the biggest payday. He's looking at the bigger and more lucrative fights for himself. Can you blame him? He really had that workmanship to get to that position. This is the thing, though. The downfall is when a fighter is a little bit too smart for the game. Boxing fans don't want to hear about negotiations. Boxing fans don't want to hear about finances. Boxing fans don't care for none of that stuff. All we want to see is a champion being active, is a fighter being a fighter, and that's getting in the ring. So that's the only backlash that I could see happening to Timothy Bradley, just almost in the mirror of what went down between him and Amir Khan.
Yeah, it's to me, I look at Peterson. There's a few issues. I mean, this is even with Berto. There's the issue of the positive drug tests that nobody's really dealing with. And in Tarver, you know, he just had his sentencing this past week, this week. He didn't have a sentencing, but they upheld his suspension for a year. He got his justice. Why aren't these guys getting their justice? Why are we even really talking about Lamont Peterson being in a fight? We're kind of skipping the whole licensing problem. The fact that he didn't test positive, but he tested positive, but he also talked about being having a substance that was a banned substance in his body for a whole other fight. I don't even understand why we're discussing the guy. You know, that's one issue. Besides,
I agree.
I don't know. It was a competitive, one-sided fight with Bradley. But, okay, just think of the matchup. It's two guys that are going to be, yeah, I guess aggressive and going to come at each other. Peterson's going to throw a lot of punches. But is there a possibility of like a one-punch knockout or like a full reversal in this fight? Or is it going to be the same kind of hard-fought, but nobody's going to get knocked out kind of fight? It's more likely the latter. So I don't really want to see that fight again. It doesn't do anything for me.
It doesn't excite me. It's just one of those fights. It's a rerun, you know, and that's pretty much, I think, how we're seeing it. I think a lot of fight fans are seeing it. You know, I mean, if you want to find out, I mean, we want to hear what the fans got to say. You can call in 347-215-7598. Tell us what you think. You want to see it? Yes, Peterson and Timothy Bradley, or nah, I'll bypass that. But here's the thing, though, is that, and my thoughts is, where does it leave Timothy Bradley at? You know, he obviously lives in the desert. But he's going to be in the desert because there's nobody really there for him to compete against. You know, Pacquiao's going for Marquez. The Guerrero fight would have been a fantastic fight for him. But you got the Cold War between top-ranking Golden Boy. And now Berto is moving on. So where does that leave Timothy Bradley at?
I think it's that old Larry Merchant thing about Yeah, just because you beat Tiger Woods doesn't mean you are Tiger Woods.
Right.
And in this case, nobody really even thinks you beat Tiger Woods. Everybody kind of is disputing it. I think with Tim, you know, I think they have to get realistic. You know, first off, he says he's been training, so the foot's fine.
Right.
Everything's on schedule there, so that's not the problem. It's that he doesn't really want to fight Peterson.
And I like the honesty about that. Honestly, I really like the fact that he's being honest. He's like, there's nothing wrong with my foot. I'm fine. I can fight. But the problem is, the guy that you guys are picking for me to fight, his promotional company, guess what? That's just not this is the thing, too, is that a lot of fighters allow the promoters to they're working for the promoter. It should be the opposite. And Timothy's using that right, which is the promoter works for me. Go out and get the fight that I want.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of agree with that. But at the same time, the promoter is putting up the money. They are risking. So I do understand that they I just look at it and I say, okay, you can I guess market Lamont Peterson. He's the guy that beat Amir Khan. But at the same time, one, there's the licensing thing. And two, I'm just not that excited by the matchup. You know, it just goes back to, for me, lack of power. I was talking to somebody yesterday, the boxing guy, with Justin Fortune. We were driving home and I said, you know, as wrong as it may seem, for me anyways, a fight's just not that great if somebody in that fight can't knock the other guy out suddenly. Like, I need that kind of conclusion. I need that kind of danger that something could happen in any moment. I do like stylists, and defense is great, and, you know, hard-fought 12-round wars are cool, but I like the danger of a knockout. This fight doesn't offer it. And Tim Bradley's wearing Grant gloves, definitely nobody's getting knocked out. So, yeah, I just think, I don't know, maybe you move on with Provodnikov, but Tim's got to be realistic about the money. If you want to fight somebody that's not pay-per-view worthy, I don't even think Peterson is, you're going to have to go 2.5 now. It's not going to be the $8 million. It's not going to be the money. I think he was thinking maybe he was going to get, you know, double your money for a Pacquiao rematch. And the public really spoke and said, we have no interest in that fight. Bob Arum's not stupid. He knows, one, it's not the greatest matchup in the world, period, for excitement. But it's not a great matchup for Pacquiao at this stage in his career. And, you know, he doesn't want to go back down that road. So Tim's kind of ass out on that. You know, the rematch, he earned the rematch or earned a shot at the rematch, but it's just not going to happen for him. So he's having trouble dealing with that, I think. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. You know, in a short bit, we're going to be having Edwin Rodriguez, La Bomba. He's going to be coming on talking about what's his next move at 168 super middleweight fighter, and who he looks to reach and get a hold of. And then a little later, we're going to have Austin Trout, who's got a big fight coming up In his end, he's going to be facing Miguel Cotto, the Puerto Rican sensation champion, a guy that's given us plenty of good fights to talk from here to all the way down to the end of his career. So some interesting interviews that we're going to be having here on Leave the Ring. And obviously, we're going to be breaking down the fights, giving the previews of the fights, and give our predictions of what we think is going to happen Friday and Saturday between myself and Gabriel Montoya. But right now, let's open up some phone lines. Let's talk to some boxing here with some folks here that have been on hold. Let's go with Always, man. I think we always put CT up first every time he calls in because he's like one of the early ones that get on board here. CT, what's up, brother?
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Doing good, man. Thank you.
Doing good, man. How you doing?
Pretty good. I'm just excited about both fights this weekend. Looking forward to both fights. I think it took me a while to even because style-wise, both of these fights this weekend are so competitively close. You know, I mean, it's really hard to pick. With the Rios and Alvarado, I'm just looking for slugfest all night. I'm really thinking of like a Gotti type, war type fight, definitely. But I think in this fight, Rios will be asked a lot of questions. Going up to 140, he's not going to have the comfort zone, and Alvarado is one of the biggest 140 pounders I've seen in my life. I thought Khan was big for 140, but Alvarado's huge.
He's massive. He's a big boy. I mean, he's a few inches taller than Rio, so that tells you a lot there. This is a big kid at 140.
I saw them both at the media workout yesterday. Well, it's not even really. It was like media day. You know, nobody worked out. But yeah, he's a bigger guy. I mean, we'll see them when they rehydrate, you know, and see who gets
right.
bigger. But I think it is going to look like a 140-pounder versus a 147-pounder in some respects. You know, we'll get to our picks later in the fight, but I don't know. I'm working on my Rios interview. I really love the way Rios approaches things. I mean, he's just a pure warrior. Like some dudes, like it's always like kind of brawler guys go, you know, my boxing skills are underrated, you know, even though like their face is totally flat and they're all beat up and they always take punches to the face, you know. But Rios, I tried to throw him that. I was like, you know, do you think even in the context of a brawl that your boxing skills are kind of underrated? And he was like, hey, I'm a fighter. I like to fight. Like, he just, you know, he's not trying to sell you anything. You know, he's just like, I'm going to go in there, and if dude doesn't try to stink out the joint, you know, and box and try something new, if he fights the way he always does, you know, Alvarado, then this could be a great fight.
I don't see either one of these guys honestly changing their personality in the ring, you know? And I think that's what makes this fight so special and so intriguing and making us already kind of giving it that label of fight of the year. Two guys I like to fight in the phone booth, two guys that like the taste and the look of blood, and two guys that like to stand and trade. This mix is, this is a great mix for boxing fans all the way.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Dude. Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, it's hard for me to pick, but if I were to pick, I'll lean a little bit towards Rios. I think rehydrating up to 140, I think it's going to help him out in a lot of ways. And I just think, you know, it's going to be up to whoever wants it more. And I think Rios, you know, his relentlessness and the way he throws his shots, you know, to the body and the head, I think it's going to take his toll longer, you know, in the long run against Alvarado. I think it's going to be tough, but I'm looking forward to a Rios stoppage late.
Really? That's
yeah.
You mean just like his volume and he'll be a little bit quicker,
yeah.
kind of be able to get his shots in between Alvarado's
right.
shots.
Yep.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that. That was the thing I was watching, because the thing that I think is kind of crafty about Rios is he does have, a lot like Jose Luis Castillo did, the like a little jab that's like to your chest as he kind of comes down to work your body. He knows how to create openings and get in there. A firefight kind of does favor him in some sense, but I really do like the physicality and the size of Alvarado. You know, it's one of those things. I mean, do you pick a good big man or a good smaller man, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
God, I can't
great.
Wait.
I think with the Donair and Ishioka fight, I think it's very good for both fighters. I think, you know, this is the high-level class where Donair is going to fight his best opponents ever fought, and I think the same thing for Ishioka. I think when you have two fighters who have, you know, good speed and good timing, it's going to be a great fight. I think for the first few rounds, it's going to take a while for each guy to, you know, get the rhythm of the other guy's, you know, speed or whatever. I think Nishoka has great timing on his left hand, and I like the way he sets it up. I think it's going to hurt him, as I think Donaire's a little bit better foot movement. I think Donaire's going to – he's definitely learned from these last couple of fights. He can't look for the knockout. He's going to be able to try to set something up. I think I could see some knockdowns in this fight, but I picked Donaire in a close decision.
Very, very interesting fight, man, for sure, you know. And before I even talk about it and break that down, I'm going to put you on hold for a minute because we're going to get our first guest in. But I do want to talk about that because, you know, this is going to be a bit of a puzzle for me, I think, you know. But CC, stay on hold, brother.
All right, thank you.
Let's see if we can call in and patch in Mr. Edwin Rodriguez here on Leaving the Ring with Us and talk some boxing with him in the super middleweight division. But, I, you know, there's a couple things that I wanted to kind of mention and bring up between Rios and Alvarado. I haven't seen a lot of folks raise these questions, and I like to raise them here on Leaving Ring and kind of find out what people think about those two warriors clashing. Hopefully Edwin answers the phone here in a short bit, or else we're going to be trying again.
You have reached Sprint voicemail box.
Okay. Well, I'll call
out. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we didn't get, at least we didn't get the last time. How many other voicemails is like they say their name right away? All excited.
Well, it's interesting, you know, yeah. the crazy voice that comes out of nowhere. You have reached the voicemail box of
Dave Duenas.
All out of context. It's weird sounding.
Does mine do that? Does it really do that?
No, it doesn't. Linus from Twitter, this is an interesting point. I always kind of trip when I'm in the middle of writing an article while doing the radio show because, one, you know, I'm definitely up against deadline. But, two, I just like the points that people bring up. It makes me think of things. He said, I think it will be a mistake for Bam Bam to war against Mike like he did against Urbano Antion. If he doesn't, he wins, in my opinion. And what's funny is, you know, this is the first time that Rios has been back to the Home Depot Center since that fight. And that's actually how I start the article, is that it's that was kind of his high watermark. Everything after that, he immediately lost his belt on the scales against John Murray. He won, and it was, you know, it was an okay fight. It was him getting away with rehydrating and making that weight one, you know, missing the weight, but just his body was giving out. But he was able to rehydrate and put on a good performance, get the stoppage. But then the next fight with Abril, he went back to the well one too many times and didn't even get a chance to fight for his belt back. And looked like crap, and I thought lost the fight. And he kind of kept talking about it in the interview about somebody brought up the Urbano Antion fight, and he kept kind of saying like if it's going to be like that, like in his mind that's the kind of fight that he wants. I don't think he's going to try to do the opposite. Is what I'm telling Linus. I think he's in trouble.
Well, you know, the thing too is that. My curiosity is, okay, 140, obviously he's not trying to starve himself like he's tried to do in the past to make the weight. He's going to still go into a division, though, that he probably is a bit little bigger than he should be. He looks more like to be a guy that should be at 147. But he's facing a guy that in some ways and somehow has been making a weight division that he really doesn't belong in at this time either. My question is, though, is that, This is going to be the first time Brandon, in my opinion, is getting in with a guy that's a lot bigger and possibly could be a lot stronger than him come fight night. The other thing, too, is that Mike Alvarado, he's been in through some wars himself. You know, we saw what happened with Prescott Herrera. He's got a lot of shots that were landed to him. There could be a wear and tear factor for himself. There could be a strong possibility that the chipping of the rock by getting Brandon Rios, who I think probably punches a little harder than Herrera and Prescott, even though he's coming from a small – well, Prescott was coming from a smaller division as well. But, you know, he may have the sledge to split this boulder into two pieces. That's my question. I think both guys have a lot to answer stepping in the ring, not just Rios. I think Mike has some answering too. You know, he's going to be facing a guy that likes to bang, who's a much bigger puncher, and who can connect to the body and come up with uppercuts. You know, there's a lot of factors into the Mike Alvarado. Mile High definitely is in for a very mile high in this fight against Rios.
Well, it's interesting. He can take – both of them shown that they can take like speedy dudes that can punch his power.
Right.
You know, Costa and Prescott.
But the difference is speedy guys, you know, there's power there, but there's not that sit down, athletics behind it and throw punches, you know, type
bone
of
rattling. Yeah.
You know, there's a huge difference in that. You're getting two guys that are going to mount and they're going to fight and they're going to try to turn their bodies and really put their weight behind their punches. Where, you know, them both facing the other guys, Herrera's a perfect example, who was using movement and he pity pats his punches at the same time. You know, that's what makes me really wonder how good of a chin do these both of these guys really have?
Well, it's going to be interesting. I kind of just thinking about it, I mean, Rios is probably has more capability of getting smaller and being a little more squirrely, you know, a little harder to hit than Alvarado, who's not, you know, he's learning how to box better. He's learning how to control distance and range and punch straight, but he's not very fluid, you know, in his upper body. Brandon's a little more fluid in his upper body. He does square up. They both square up. That's why it's such a great fight. You know, they're going to be facing each other, just hitting each other. It's really hard to pick. When you start to really truly break it down, I've already made my pick, but yeah, I just can't wait to see it, dude. It's gonna be. I hope that my seat is right there in the center. I hope it's all good. I hope the internet works. And
I'm gonna try to get a hold of Edwin Rodriguez here real quick and see if we can get him on so we can conduct our interview. A little later, we got Austin Trout. No doubt he's going to be facing Miguel Cotto and talk some boxing with him and about his strategy and what he's going to do with Miguel Cotto. It's a big step up for him. A lot of people, I think, undermining what Trout brings to the table, you know. I've said this before. I've said this in interviews on other radio shows that have asked me to be on is that, you know, don't think much of Trout. But, you know, people don't think much of Trout. But the thing that Trout brings is he's a steady and he's – yeah, can I please speak to Edwin?
Yes, this is him.
Hey, how you doing, brother? This is Dave Duenas and my partner, Gable Montoya. We have a scheduled Leaving the Ring radio interview, brother.
Yes, sir.
First off, hey, man, thanks for taking the time, you know, to speak to us. I know you're with the family, the familia, and you're enjoying yourself, especially with a, you know, spectacular win you had a couple of weeks back.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, my first question is going to be is that I've read and kind of seen that you're asking to possibly get in with Arthur Abraham. Is that true?
Yeah, we wonder if I, you know, got a top 10. There's so many talent at 168 that, you know, it doesn't really matter if it's Arthur Abraham or any other top 10 guy. I know Kelly Pavlik and a couple other big names. I feel that I had two HBO fights. And I just need to take that, you know, big fight to get me to the next level.
And let me ask you this, because, you know, with your fight with Donovan George, you know, it was a good fight. It was, you know, you obviously were having the much upper hand in that fight. But it to me, am I wrong? Was there a little bit of jitters just because you were debuting on HBO? Because the second time around, you just seemed so much more fluent. You know, you seem more comfortable. It just looked like, you know, it was your night.
You know, with the Donovan George fight, it was a fight that, you know, I was working on defense a lot with Ronnie Shields, and I feel like I improved a lot in my defense, but I wasn't able to put together my defense and my offense. And I think that against Scalera in my last fight, I was able to do that, and that's what I was looking to in this fight. But, you know, the Donovan George fight was a good fight because I was able to show the fan and everybody involved in boxing that I had defense. Unfortunately, I wasn't happy with the fight because I got away from being offensive and being fan-friendly. But I believe that I did that in this fight, so I'm thrilled.
I thought it was a great performance, man. I mean, I was right after that, I was even tweeting. I said, I thought you looked great. I think me and my partner, I agreed on this. We saw the minor changes from you being with Ronnie Shields, you know. But I'll let my partner conduct his questions.
Hey, how you doing, Edwin? Welcome to the show. It's Gabriel Montoya.
Hey,
I'm doing good, man. Thank you. Dave went right down the lane I wanted to drive in. You've really, each fight seems to be a step forward for you, technically. You get more comfortable. But also, you know, in terms of your nutrition, as I understand it, you've really kind of just taken control of everything. But I'm curious, you know, it seems like you'd put on, I think, what, 20 pounds or something like that after the weigh-in, how many times do you think you can go to the well at 68 before you're going to have to move up? Or do you feel, you know, any adverse effects from putting on so much weight?
I feel like, you know, eventually I'm going to have to move up to 175, but I feel like I got a couple of years at 168. I make 68 comfortably. Yeah, you know, I have a good training in Houston, Texas with Ronnie Shield. I'm able to, you know, learn, and this is our fifth fight with Ronnie, and I feel like I'm starting to put everything together now. You know, the way that Ronnie teaches you and trains you is not, he doesn't only, you know, tells you what he wants you to do. He makes it becomes a habit. You know, we're doing it and over again in practice, during sparring, and by the time you have the fight, it becomes a habit, and you don't even know that you're doing what he wants you to do.
He's got a very calm kind of attitude, the way he approaches things. I mean, is he a guy that does a lot of repetition? How does he go about teaching?
You know, he's one of the few teachers left in the game of boxing. One of the few coaches that actually sit down and teaches. You know, when I work with Ronnie, the one-to-one is just me and him. And like I said, you know, we work on the things that he wants me to do, the game plan, but he just doesn't tell me what the game plan is going to be. Basically, he has me practicing the way he wants me to fight during sparring, while we're doing the mitts. And at the end of the day, I really don't have a choice but to do what he wants me to do, because it just becomes a habit, because I'm doing it day in and day out. And when it comes to the fight, all I need from Ronnie really is reminders of the things that we've been doing in the gym that are basically just becoming habits, and I just need a little reminders of, you know, fight them in the middle of the ring, step around after you finish your combination, and depending on who we're going to fight, you know, obviously it's going to change. And
yeah. Was it a lot of it, too? Was it a matter of unlearning things that you'd learned before? Was he just showing you a whole new ways to fight? Or just certain moves like that?
You know, one of the big things is, you know, a lot of trainers, just because I like to take chances, and they thought that, you know, my defense wasn't as good as it should have been. They thought that by me putting my hands up was going to actually help. You know, in my case, when I actually put my hands up, I get a little, you know, not lazy, but get a little too comfortable. So when I have at least one hand down, I'm able to see the punches coming. I get in a groove. I feel good, and I want to move my head and stuff like that. So I think that works better for me. But, you know, the way he teaches, just you just get it. Like I said, you don't really have a choice, because it's day in and day out, you know, doing the things that
right.
he wants you to do for the.
Who in his stable do you get to work with? Because he still has Lara, as I understand it, right?
Yes, he has Lara.
He's a little smaller than you.
Yeah, he's smaller. He's 154. I mean, I worked with him one time to help him out against Paul Williams, because Paul Williams was tall. I'm not a lefty, but, you know, I worked with him lefty for that fight, helped him out a little bit. He was beating up his sparring partner, so he needed a little bit of help. So it was just a couple of days. I work with Cornelius White. Ronnie doesn't train him, though. He trains with Frank Tate. I work with him a lot. Don Mutong and a couple of other guys. It's Thomas Bond in Houston, Texas, for me. I also work with Mike Lee, that Ronnie trains.
Oh, that's
a young kid that, you know, is coming up and works hard and is learning quite fast.
What do you think about him? Do you think he's a guy that he kind of came to it a little late, as I understand it. Do you think he's a guy that he's going to have to be developed over time? Or is he a natural athlete that's adapting to fighting pretty quickly?
He is definitely an athlete, but I think that him having a short amateur background, he's going to, you know, keep learning, you know, in the job. And I think he has been doing that. He works extremely hard in the gym. He's really dedicated.
That's what I understand.
And, you know, he has the right back in it, and I think he's going to be able to, just like Chavez was able to get better fight by fight, where people actually gave him a chance against Sergio Martinez before the fight.
where before people were like, oh, you crazy, Sergio will kill him. Which he, you know, gave him a boxing lesson. But before the fight, everybody was, you know, saying that he actually had a chance.
Right.
And I think that Mike Lee is going to be able to keep learning and keep getting better because he's hungry and he, you know, he loves the sport. And he's really dedicated, and I think that he's going to be able to put it together and keep improving. I think he already has done a great job working with Rooney as well.
Let's talk a little bit about, because you brought up something that when we talk about the weight, you know, 20 pounds over, what Julio did against Sergio Martinez, and your nemesis, if you had to have one, would be Andre Ward. And it would be similar in terms of weight, but in terms of boxing skills, you're far more skilled than Julio obviously was when he stepped in with Martinez. How far along do you think that you need to reach to that point to get a shot at Andre Ward? Or do you feel that maybe one more fight and you should be ready for Ward?
Yeah, I think that it's more about me actually proving myself to the fans and the boxing people by beating a guy that's in the top 10 before I'm able to challenge Andre Ward. Because he already has beaten, you know, basically everybody in the super middleweight division.
Division, right.
So I think I'm ready now, but I need to prove that, and I think that's why I need to fight a guy like Kelly Pavlik, Arthur Abraham, one of those big names where I could look good beating one of those guys, and I'm able to challenge, you know, him and Carl Froch, because I think they are the next level.
Well, let me present a scenario to you, though. Let's say you get that guy, like a Kelly Pavlik. You get past that fight, and then you do have a Ward or a Froch. You could look at that. But what if, in the meantime, Chavez Jr. moved to 168?
Hmm.
What would be the most attractive fight for you in that scenario?
I'd love to fight Chavez Jr.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I think it's a great style matchup, right? I mean, you guys...
I think so, too. I think it would be a great fight. He's a tough kid, takes a ton of punches, and keeps coming forward, and I think it would be a fun night.
I would have to go with my predict. I think you stop him.
Wow. Nice.
I think Dave. So, too.
Dave with the early pick. I'd have to watch. I don't want to see you guys in camp, but I'm more non-committal than Dave.
Well, I'm, you know, styles make fights, you know. I mean,
yeah, I think you're a better boxer. Your defense is
defense,
better.
Defense, hand speed, and putting the punches together, you know, I would rate, you know, Edwin way above Julio. I mean, Julio to me is still learning. He has improved, but I truly still believe that he has a lot to improve, where I think Edwin's ready to almost shine, maybe 2-3 more fights. You know, the only thing my concern about Edwin is that beating a Kelly Pavlik or an Arthur Abraham, I'm not sure that those two guys would be the guys to say that you're ready for a Ward. Maybe somebody with some fast hands and some more ring generalship, then I think that more people would be intrigued, you know? Because obviously, you have the advantage with the hand speed, the boxing skills, and the size against Pavlik and Arthur Abraham.
I agree. I think that I need to fight somebody with similar style to Ward. But there's really nobody that fights like Ward, really.
Right. Yeah, that's true, too.
That's the thing. I mean, that's what I was going to ask you, because looking at your record, you kind of look at it, and is there a guy that's kind of a style that you haven't faced that would, one, prepare you for a Ward, who I guess you could, you know, an athletic, fast guy, maybe? I mean, yeah, it is kind of hard to define him. But is there a style that you haven't faced that you would like to?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I have faced lefties. I have faced Aaron Pryor, who was 6'5", with an 83-inch reach.
Yeah.
So I think I have seen it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. What's that? Go ahead, Dave.
I was going to ask, do you decide, you know, to fly out to Europe possibly? I mean, if Mikel Kessler is a huge name over there and he's obviously the big draw, would you fly out to go face one of the European champions, Carl Froch? You mentioned him, but would you leave U.S. soil to go somewhere else that's foreign and take the chance of blemishing your record?
If it was televised, I think I would take a chance because, you know, people will be able to see it and they'll be able to tell a clear winner. But, yeah, I'm willing to do that because, you know, Mikhail Kessler has a title now. I'm not sure. But I know Kyle Froch has a title in England. So if I would want to get his title, I'll have to go to his country and get it because he is a champ. So, I know that Arthur Abraham also has a title, and he's from out of country. So, you know, the only one that has a title is Andre Ward, that's from the USA. So, you know, until we get to fight a guy like him, we're going to have to travel and get it somewhere else. And I'm willing to do that. I would like it to be on TV, but if it's not, I'm still willing to do that as well.
I wouldn't blame you if it wasn't on TV. You know what I mean? You want the exposure. That's the whole reason, is to convince people. You know, I kind of agree with you on that one. I'm sorry, Gabe, I cut you off. Go ahead, brother.
Oh, no, that's okay. Somebody on Twitter, Matthew Mojica, the Fight Source, said the Darrell brothers. That would be an interesting – either one of them would be interesting. You know, it would be
They mentioned something about, you know, Anthony before he was going to get the mandatory for the WBC, Andre Ward vacated against somebody, and I don't even know how he got to be the number one for the WBC, but somehow he did. You know, the only guy he beat was the guy from Canada, what was his name, Rene St. Juice, who recently lost to Marcus Upshaw, who I beat in my sixth professional fight. So, you know, it was a shocker. So we wanted to get that fight, but he got into that accident. Hopefully he's feeling better and comes back and healthy.
Right.
And I'll see what happens down the road.
Let me ask you just more. I'm always curious about Ronnie Stable. What's your take on Arislandi Lara? He's got that fight coming up with Vanas. I don't know if you've been in the gym while he's training, but how far do you think he can go? He's coming on in the last year or two.
I think he could go all the way. I think this is a very talented kid. I know with that fight against Molina, he kind of, you know, he has so much talent that he kind of took that fight lightly a little bit. And it was a close fight. But, you know, other than that, I think he beat Paul Williams, who was a really good fighter.
Yeah.
You know, he's very talented, very skilled, works hard in the gym. You know, he's one of those guys that you look at and you want to learn from because they you know, and the amateurs, Cuba was huge. And in the pros, him and Guillermo Rigondeaux and a couple of other guys that came from the Cuban team have a ton of experience and a ton of amateur background. And, you know, you want to look at them and see. But I think he has a great future ahead of him, and I think this is going to be a great fight against another undefeated prospect, former Olympian. It's going to be exciting. I know he's working hard for it. He basically started camp a couple of weeks before I finished mine, and I was able to play some video games with him and stuff. So,
what games do you guys play?
He likes to play the soccer game. I like to play the boxing game. I was playing with him.
That's awesome. Last thing, I'm kind of curious fighters' takes on fights. Who do you like in Rios Alvarado? And oh, I'm sorry, Dave's actually got a question. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, no, I was going to ask him what is his thoughts about Jermaine Taylor, you know, fighting this Friday. I mean, you know, there's an Olympian, big name still, and seems like they're still willing to throw him out there to try to keep him active. I mean, what do you think, Edwin?
You know, Jermaine Taylor at one point was somebody when I was still an amateur that I looked up to as a fighter. You know, he was an undisputed middleweight champion after he beat Bernard Hopkins. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced yet if he's, you know, ready to be fighting one of the top guys. But I wish him the best, and I just wish that everything goes well for him and he stays healthy. But, you know, he wouldn't be one of the guys that I wouldn't like to fight Jermaine Taylor just because I think that he should be fighting anymore.
Yeah, I gotta agree with you, man, and I like your answer with that, the honesty behind that, saying, you know, it's just not one of the guys that would want to fight, just to, you know, because some fighters would be, well, he's got a name, you know, and a name's always looks good on the resume, but sometimes names, just having that name doesn't justify the bout being made. You know what I mean? And I got to tell you that even when watching your fights and getting the chance that HBO did that, you know, short clip about your family, you know, which was very, very touching. At the same time, I also kind of felt like, you know, there was a human connection that you made with fans, and you've gained a lot of fans. I mean, I was a fan in the beginning, but you just made me that much more of a fan of saying, man, I want to see this guy again, because I saw the passion behind not just the skills, but to maintain, you know, the push, you know. And I love the fact when you said that your kids have been in tougher fights than you, you know, that what you do for a living, it doesn't compare what they've had to, you know, obviously the obstacles they had to jump.
It doesn't. I mean, we got to see them, you know, get poked every day just to make sure that everything was good, that the oxygen and you know, so like the times that we went through, it was just real, real tough to see your kids go through when they had no clue what was going on. And
how do you maintain that, you know, mentally? Because, you know, a lot of us, including myself, we just couldn't imagine going through that, watching your kids, you know, putting needles in them and, you know, put them in the hospital and or whatever the case, whatever you had to go through. How do you maintain the focus, though, to go into your career and at the same time, when you have that in the back of your head of what's going on?
My wife is crying. My wife is crying now because of it. I mean, it's hard to get away from it as much as you try. Usually my wife used to get mad at me because I didn't really like to talk about it anymore, mm-hmm. just because I was just trying to, you know, move on from it and not forget that it happened, but kind of just, you know, not feel sorry, because that's not how we,
right.
you know, live life. That's not what I want to teach my kids either. You know, I want to be able to, yeah, it was tough times. You guys fought through it. You guys are doing great now. That's just...
I got to tell you, I didn't feel sorry for you. But what I felt was that as a Latino, as a Latino man, you know, when we hear a lot of people saying, you know, that Latinos don't step up to the plate, you know, there's always the joke that, you know, you're grown without a father. I got to tell you, man, that you're a very positive, as a human being, a very positive human being to be there. And that's what I thought was the most touching part, was to see somebody out there that's a fighter and at the same time is human and goes through these obstacles in life, because a lot of times we don't want to talk about those things. So I applaud you, man, and all the fullness and stuff of not only being a fighter and doing what you're doing, but at the same time being a husband and a father.
Thank you, man. I really, really appreciate it.
Go ahead, Gabriel. What's your question? Let me see. Did Gabriel fall off? He wanted to.
I got emotional. No, I was on mute. No, I share Dave's sentiments. You know, the good Latino role models are hard to come by a lot of the time, and just good father and good human being. And it
right.
is, he said, very, very positive. This last thing, I wanted to get your fighter's take on this weekend's war, the Rios Alvarado and the boxing match above it, Donaire Nishioka. Do you have particular picks, or do you even watch the other divisions? Are you a boxing fan?
Oh yeah, I'm a big boxing fan. Especially a fighter like Rios. He just, you know, he's a tough dude. You know, he's never in a dull fight. Actually looking forward to that, because Alvarado could also bring it. So it's gonna be a really good fight as long as it lasts. I am picking Rios though, and Nonito Donaire is one of my favorite fighters now. I think he has speed, power, ring generalship, and I really applaud that him doing a 24/7 with a 360 drug testing.
Yeah,
That's something that, you know, like I said, I applaud it, because there's so many fighters that have been tainted and have come out with failing drug tests. You know, for him to step up and do that voluntarily says a lot about him, not only as a fighter, but as a person.
I 100% agree. You know, especially in this, it's the most dangerous sport there is. You know,
there is. It's not like you don't play boxing. You know, like you play baseball, you play basketball, but you don't play boxing. You don't play with other people's lives just because you want to be greedy and make a lot of money and put somebody else's.
Oh, I like that. I like that. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's a dangerous sport as it is already.
Yeah,
but in a way too, it's scary. I mean, at the same time, like no needle. You know, I mean, how many fighters have we seen, like including Berto and Peterson, that are not aware of what they're putting into their bodies? You know, and for him to just kind of go blind. I mean, he could say whatever he wants, but at the same time, it's got a trail in the back of your mind that there could be something that was contaminated and it's in your system and you don't even know about it.
Yeah, that you know that could happen, but it's a small percentage.
Right.
It's a small, you know, percentage of it that could happen. And
yeah, it's pretty rare.
You know. So I think he's doing the right thing, and I think that a lot of other fighters are going to start doing that, and it's going to make the sport better.
Do you think it will catch on? Because, I mean, you know, it just seems like, you know, he did it, you know. I heard other guys were kind of asking about it. Berto did it. The guys that got caught, I'm not sure if they're going to go back and do it again. You know, it seems controversial. It isn't. I mean, what VADA's asking people to do is make it fighter-driven. Do you think it has to come from the commissions, or do you think it can catch fire and the other fighters start to do it too?
I think that us as athletes and fighters and knowing the risk we're putting ourselves in, I think that we should step up and start doing it ourselves so that other fighters start doing it. I have spoken with my promoter and my manager about it. And hopefully soon for my next fight or so, we'll start doing it as well. But, you know, somebody has to start it, so.
Yeah.
Start somewhere.
100% agree, man. Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on. I hope that works out with, you know, I know Lou says he's for it, so I hope that you guys are able to do it for your next fight and step forward and, you know, another clean athlete. That would be awesome. But yeah,
that'd be great, man. Thank you.
Hey,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, brother, and I apologize for making your wife cry, man.
Yeah, Dave, what the hell?
No, man. Edwin Rodriguez with us here on Leaving the Ring. If you missed the interview, don't worry. It's going to replay as soon as we're off the air. Hey, Edwin, again, brother, wish you all the luck in the world. Can't wait to hear the announcement of your next fight. Thanks again, tons, for coming on Leaving the Ring and speaking to us.
All right, guys. Take care. Dave, take it easy. All right, guys.
All right,
man. All right, man. Take care.
Well, there you go. La Bomba here on Leaving the Ring. And I like the kid's honesty. You know, I mean.
He's actually supposed to be very, very good at fight night.
Really?
When we were originally doing Fighter versus Rider, when we were just doing it as an online version, that was one of the guys recommended to get him on. And we discontinued that version of the show, and he doesn't live in Los Angeles, and we don't have the money to fly him out, so we never able to hook it up. But everybody said, like, yeah, that's the guy. He's like the king of Fight Night. That's why I was like, I'm going to avoid that. I'm semi-retired, so.
I know. You still haven't beaten Isha Shea Smith.
I know. I want my rematch. I really do want my rematch.
Fight fans, you want to call in right now. We just finished conducting our interview with Edwin La Bomba Rodriguez here on Leaving the Ring. In a short bit, we're going to have Austin Trout. No doubt. I'm eating some candy and it's getting stuck in my throat here.
Nice.
No doubt. Who's going to be facing Miguel Cotto? And we're going to talk some boxing with him. 347-215-7598. Hey, check this out. We're going to start doing this thing on Leaving the Ring. It's called the Leaving the Ring Hangout, where we're going to preview some fights and BS some about those fights. BS. We're going to talk about those fights. Well, you can tune in and hang out with us, and we can watch the fights together on the internet. And we should be able to chop it up and pull some people in to talk to us live and in the chat room. It's going to be on you. It's going to be on our YouTube channel, which is 97 Rough, and it's live there. So look for it. We'll announce the date we're going to do it. We're going to figure out, me and Gabriel, what fights we want to present on there, and it should be a lot of fun, man. If you're a diehard boxing fan like ourselves. And love to just kind of go back on fight dates that have happened that were previous and just want to get on there and just chop it up some boxing. This is going to be the hangout on Leaving the Ring.
Oh, somebody just tweeted me. Did you read Robert Morales' story today? It was very, very interesting. They didn't send me the link, though, so I can't pull it up and quote it. But he was just talking about Bob Arum, and Bob was full of some gems yesterday. He was just throwing out, talking about why Guerrero and Bradley didn't happen, and talking about weed, and it was just, yeah, Bob is...
He's
just... boxing can be different. Bob is not in the business.
I know. I did see a little bit about it. I read a little bit about it. Not see. I did read a little bit about it. I didn't get too much into it. But, you know, Fight Fans, if you know a little bit more about what the quotes were from Bob Arum, obviously you can call in and chop it up here. If you got your predictions of what's going to happen Friday or Saturday night, hey, call in. Tell us who you think is going to who's going to win. Even though Nonito's the headline, a lot of folks are talking more about Brandon Rios and Mike Mile High Alvarado. That's the fight that a lot of people are anticipating. It's going to be a fun friendly fight for the fight fans out there.
I'm pulling up the link. It's come on, computer.
Oh, you know what we got to do is we got to call in Austin Trout. I'm looking at the clock and we're flying by pretty quick here.
Is he our 6 o'clock guest?
He is our 5:45 guest.
Ooh.
So, yeah, let me
While you're doing that, basically, Bob said he talked about why Bradley Guerrero didn't happen. He said HBO interceded and they offered Schaefer $1.2 million, and Schaefer offered Guerrero $600,000 out of the $1.2 million. Anybody who does that is reprehensible. But worse than that, somebody who professes to have formed this company to aid the fighters and not take advantage, that's even worse. So it wasn't the fact that Guerrero was being greedy, he wanted his fair share. Bob just likes to drop some bombs.
The old man still got him. He still has it in him to, you know, say what he's got to say. I heard Schaefer too was dropping his bombs too at the same time, you know.
Yeah, he.
Thank you for calling No Doubt Entertainment.
Yeah, let me text him and let him know that we're going to call him.
This was something, and actually, this is in my Rio story tonight. But he was—I was asking them, like, you know, what are the options past this fight with Donaire? I mean, you know, can you make a Morris fight, or you know, what are the other fights at 122? And he got around to Morris and was like, you know, I said, yeah, but he's with Golden Boy and the Cold War and all that, and he said, nothing lasts forever. He was referring to, I think, Morris's contract. I don't think he was talking about the Cold War. and basically, and they have Robert has similar quotes, but he kind of just blamed the fact that you know, Golden Boy went over to Showtime. They have basically an exclusive output deal, is how he kind of put it, and over there, and the other company, he didn't really say his, but he referred to the other company being his, is at HBO, and so. The fighters are going to have to choose which company they want to be and which network, or you know, or the networks are going to have to start working together. But that's never really worked either. So he said, you know, this Cold War thing is really just about the networks. It's really not so much about the promoters. I don't necessarily believe that.
Story. Yeah, come on.
But that's his take. You know.
I mean, if that's the case, then what is Oscar always talking about? You know. Hopefully he answers. Austin Trout, just text him, let him know that we're trying to get a hold of him. On Leaving the Ring, we have a scheduled interview with him. It was supposed to be 5:45. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, can I please speak to Austin Trout?
May I ask who's calling?
This is Dave Duenas and Gabriel Montoya. We have a scheduled interview here on our live radio show, Leaving the Ring.
Oh, yes, sir. That's right. 1 second, please.
Okay, no problem.
Hello, how you doing?
Doing good, man. Hey, thanks for taking the time to speak to us here on Leaving the Ring Radio, brother.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for thinking of me.
You know, we've had you on prior before that, and, you know, it was always fun speaking to you, and we always wanted to find out when you were going to get the big shot, the big move, and obviously you got it against Miguel Cotto, so congratulations on getting that fight. When you found out you were going to get Miguel Cotto, what ran through your mind?
I see disbelief initially, you know, like, come on, stop playing me, don't pull my leg, you know, Trout versus Cotto in the Garden sounds wonderful, but so does Trout versus Ali, you know what I'm saying, on
right.
Jupiter, So after, you know, it was really, you know, they really told me that it's really, really happening. You know, I didn't even know what to think. It was just like, you know, thank you, God. Like, this is what I've been waiting for. It's what I asked for. And, you know, you handed it to me. So, you know, pure gratefulness was basically how I felt.
You know, does it take you to another of a level of respect to the champion, giving one of the top contenders the chance to shine, the chance to take the torch away from them? You know, because, you know, in one of your press releases, I love the fact that you were mentioning when contenders challenge the name fighter and they shined off of it, and you basically put yourself in that category saying, this is going to be my opportunity. This is my chance to capture glory.
Yeah, no, and just for the record, you know, I'm the champion. He's challenging me for my title.
Right.
But definitely, you know, I have to give even more respect than I have, you know, from Miguel Cotto. And I had tons of respect for him because he's never shied away from a fight. You know, he's always fought the toughest, the best out there. And for him to give me a chance like this, you know, I know he knows it's risky moving and it's a high-risk, fairly low-reward type of fight, but... You know, I tip my hat off for giving me this opportunity. Like you said, this is my chance and my time to be able to showcase what I have and show the world that I'm where I belong.
Yeah, definitely. You know, real typical hard fight. I was really surprised about the fact that he was willing to get in with you. I mean, even in this stage of his time in his career, even with the performance he had with Floyd, I really thought that this is a very tough match for him. And, hey, kudos to him and stuff, but more kudos to you for getting the fight. Gabriel?
Hey, Austin, how are you, man? Thank you for coming on.
No, thanks for having me, Gabe. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. You know, the last fight, you know, we talked about it afterwards with Delvin Rodriguez. I expected him to be more in character and be more of a brawler. Instead, he decided to box, and you're more of a pure boxer in a lot of ways. And so the fight wasn't as exciting as we thought it would be. How do you think Miguel Cotto and you were going to match up? Because he has a number of ways that he can fight. Do you think it's going to be kind of an action fight similar to the way Mayweather-Cotto was?
I think so. I believe so. You know, he had the game plan to fight Mayweather, and who is a pure boxer like myself, and I feel like he's going to come out with the same game plan. But we also know that Miguel Cotto can box a bit, you know. Pedro Diaz has worked with him on his boxing skills. But I don't feel like it's going to be the same thing as Delvin Rodriguez. Delvin being a 6'1", you know, tall, lanky fighter, Miguel being a shorter fighter, you know, if he does try to box me, that means he's going to be staying on the outside, which is not a good look for him, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's to me, people are looking at you probably as the underdog in this, but do you think that's only based on experience or the fact that they haven't really seen a lot of you?
Yes, exactly. I feel like people that don't know, you know, what I have is because they haven't seen what I have, you know. Some of my best fights were off TV in another country somewhere, and I know what I have. So it's not what people think, it's what I know. And, you know, I can't wait to show and prove them wrong.
With him, he's probably the hardest interview out of any fighter I talked to. I just think he's kind of a mystery of a person. He seems to have become a little warmer in public in recent years. But as a fighter, I think that carries over for him. You can never really tell where he's going to be coming from, how he's going to exactly approach a fight. Particularly in recent years, as you said, he's become more of a boxer. What do you see as his greatest strength? I mean, not to give away your game plan. But what do you see when you look at him, like just technically?
Well, you know, technically, I feel like he's gotten a lot more sound. He used to kind of bow and arrow his shots, meaning when he throws one punch, his hand will fall back. Pedro's done a great job at fixing a couple of those technical things, but I see him having a great left hook. You know, he's a good body puncher. You know, he has a good jab. And those are some of the strengths that we are looking to neutralize.
You know, going back what Gabriel was talking about you know, your style and your temperament and stuff, do you play into his adjustments, or do you make him try to adjust to what you do, you know, what you're really good at? I kind of tend to kind of see him to try to make him adjust to you, and you stick into what you know what to do best for yourself.
But they don't want to do both. You know, I want to definitely, you know, execute my game plan, do what I do best. And then if he makes adjustments, then we'll adjust to those adjustments. If that kind of answers your question.
Let me ask you, do you think that you're actually the very first real 154-pounder he's going to be facing?
Well, without a doubt. And then I think that, hey, Yuri Foreman was a real 154-pounder, but we know he's not known for his strength.
Right.
I feel like I'm his first real 154-pounder that he's fought that could actually do something, you know, that could pose a threat as far as hurting him. You know, if you don't look at me as a puncher, but, you know, every person that I fought, they leave the fight marked up. And a lot of times they don't want to engage because they can't hit me, and they do get hit with something that they don't like. So I want to show everybody that I do have power. Obviously, you know, there was two or three fights that I was fighting super middleweights coming down, and I pushed them back. So, you know, I know I have enough power to at least keep them off me, if not put them down.
You're going to be fighting against the crowd, and whenever Miguel Cotto lands, you know the crowd's going to yell. Even if he misses, they're going to, you know, have a big roar. So with that being said, in your mind frame, do you got to return with something else, one or two, to make sure the judges are not persuaded by applause and screaming and cheering?
Well, actually, my plan is to actually shut the whole Madison Square Garden up. You know, if we got the garden silent, then that means I'm doing everything right. So hopefully, you know, we got... The crowd is not going to be a factor, not in my mind. You know, they might do all the cheering and applauding that they want, but really it's just me and him in there, and I don't let none of that outside, you know, distraction distract me.
I like that.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, like it's the silence is going to be the applause, like Jordan, you know?
Exactly, exactly.
I remember the silence of you know, Calderon when Segura, you know, beat him and stuff. That's silence.
Right.
I'm really curious. You know, there was this period where they thought you were going to fight Sal Alvarez, and then that fight didn't happen. What did you do in between? Kind of wondering, like, you know, did I make the right move? You know, all the moves that I'd made. You know, am I ever going to get a shot at a big name? Was there a period of doubt there before? All of a sudden, it was, you know, out of nowhere, you were in the Cotto sweepstakes. I mean, for me, if Cotto's picking opponents, I can't think of a tougher matchup. I mean, except maybe if
right.
you were like, you know, a Julian Jackson one-punch knockout guy. I mean, you're a slick guy with size on him and a lot of advantages. I'm honestly not kissing your ass. I'm picking you kind of going away in this. I think it's a tough fight, but I think 8-4, 7-5, I think you're going to do it. So what was in between there?
Yeah,
you're welcome.
No, it was never doubt. I just felt when I didn't get the Canelo fight, I just looked at it like, you know, God has something else in store for me. You know, it's all about the path, you know, the journey to get to where we want to get. And I never thought of it as something I did. You know, that Canelo didn't pick me because, you know, he had his own insecurities about fighting me, obviously. So, yeah, I just knew that maybe I had to, you know, take out into more contenders to get that big fight, or just keep chopping the tree down, which I'm willing to do. But, you know, lo and behold, God ended up giving me a blessing with this leap called the Miguel Cotto fight.
Yeah, it's just kind of unbelievable, man. I mean, it's you really look at the scenario, too, just where you're at in terms of your age. You're starting to peak physically. Would you say you're at your peak or near your peak?
Yeah, I like to say I'm starting to peak. I don't believe I'm at my peak. I think there's a lot... more improvement I can do.
So you think when people say they're peaking, it's like Tito as he was entering, like, you know, leaving 154, heading into 160. You start your experience, your physical, everything starts to come together, and you're not quite there yet.
Right. I don't think I'm quite there yet, but I am getting better as we go. So, you know, as long as I keep getting better, I feel like I'm not quite at my peak yet.
You're not really known as a big puncher, you know. Maybe that's just your style because you're moving. You're not a guy that, like, sits all the way down in the shot and is really looking to knock a guy out. But do you think you could be that if you needed to be? And do you think you can do that with Cotto? I mean, he's kind of like an uppercut. You know, I always look at him and say he's just dying to have an uppercut come at him. You know?
Yeah,
definitely. Definitely. I feel like, you know, one of the things that we're going to have to do to beat Miguel Cotto is put leather on him. Like, it's not, I'm going to have to let my hands go. You know, I'm not saying that this is going to be an easy fight, but it's definitely going to be a possible fight to win. And one of the things that I'm going to have to do is get his respect by hurting him. And I feel like I'm very capable of doing that. And we're working on sitting down on shots and you know, letting him go. And it's been working great in the gym thus far.
Yeah, guys that have been really successful against Miguel Cotto have, you know, Manny Pacquiao to even Antonio Margarito, have put a lot of pressure on him. Even in the past, like when he fought Torres, it seemed to me guys that go to him and match him power for power, Miguel kind of folds up. Do you see that, Austin, too? That he kind
I do. I see that, yeah. And I also see that he kind of gasses about a bit, you know, in the later round. You know, like he's got the new trainer that's given him a new rejuvenated legs, in my opinion, but, you know, like I said, I'm the bigger guy, though. You know, I'm going to lean on him, I'm going to push him back, I'm going to show him that I'm the bigger man.
I like this fight a whole lot. You know, I know a lot of fight fans, you know, that are Miguel Cotto fans are not really boxing fans, you know, and when this fight was announced, I was like, wow, first off, we all know why Saul Canelo didn't go after you. It would have been, you know, financially, in the logic choice would not have been after you. You're too solid. You're a true 154. For Miguel Cotto to say, I'm going to step up and challenge you, that to me told me the character and where he wants to meet himself in greatness, you know. But I don't know if he can be so great against you, you know, because I've spoken to a lot of people and they go, like, what do you think about Austin Trout? And I've said this, solid, solid. Does he have the special effects that people are always looking for? No, but he's a solid 154-pounder. I would literally put you in with anybody, and it would be a very difficult pick to have any of the guys at 154 beat you. This is a great fight, man, a solid fight.
No, I'm excited. I can't be more excited. And like you said, this does show his character and the heart that he has. You know, he wants to be great, and he's not looking for an easy fight after his loss to Mayweather. But, you know, at the same time, I feel like he messed up. Two losses in a row is not a good look, and that's what I'm going to give him December 1st.
Definitely. Hey, man. Hey, Austin, thanks again, brother, for taking the time to speak to us here live on Leaving the Ring. Wish you all the luck, and I hope to get a chance to chop it up with you before you guys step into the ring.
That'd be great, man. Thank you guys again for putting me on.
All right, brother. Our pleasure, man. Take care.
There you go, Austin. No doubt, Trout. Say no doubt about it. He's going to make Miguel Cotto feel his power. And who is the bigger man the day they step into the ring and face each other? You know, like I said, I'm very surprised in how many Miguel Cotto fans are – I wouldn't say they're being disrespectful. They're rooting for their guy, but they're not giving him a chance in this fight. And that really stuns me because – to me, this is, I mean, even facing Floyd Mayweather, who's granted is one of the best fighters right now out there, but he was not Floyd is not a legitimate 154, you know, and Ricardo Mayorga was not a legitimate 154, you know, and Yuri Foreman was, but Austin said it right. There was a guy that didn't fight like a 154. He didn't plan himself, you know, he was much more of a mover. Austin Trout is a little bit different, you know, doesn't have the speed and the, you know, the special effects that you see like Roy Jones and Floyd Mayweather do, but he's got that steady work, that steady pace. And a lot of times that steady work and steady pace is just enough to beat a guy like Miguel Cotto.
Yeah. I look at this fight and as crazy as it sounds, you kind of almost look at the Yuri Foreman fight. And Austin can move around, you know, just as well, if not better. He's a little more settled. He has two good knees.
Right.
But that movement kind of can trouble Cotto. While he can move a bit, if you're faster afoot and more used to being that kind of fighter, I think you can give him a lot of trouble. And Austin being a southpaw, he's going to walk him into that shot. That's going to be a problem. There's all kinds of things that – I think just have Cotto at a disadvantage here. Trout, I think he can let his hands go. I think he can be an aggressive fighter. I think he needs to kind of control it and not there was that fight. It was a Frank Laporto that was really kind of a sloppy. It was Trout trying to be that kind of guy, the action guy, is what it felt like. And he got kind of out of character, and he just got out of his wheelhouse, and it became a sloppy fight until he stopped the guy. He's got to stay in that control that he had with Rodriguez, but not be reluctant. You know, like you said, put some leather on him and really get in there. But do it in a non-greedy kind of way. You know, get your shots, get off to the side. Get your shots, get off to the side. I think that's what it's going to be all about for him. But like I said, you know, I'm picking him. You know, not running away as in a blowout, but I feel very confident in picking off
sure
drop by decision.
I'm not so confident about that. I still think that this is like I said, he's got the tools to beat a Miguel Cotto. But even in this interview, he did mention he's a smart kid. We've had him on before. You know, I mean, he's a very intelligent guy. He's obviously intelligent in the ring, you know. But Miguel does bring different faces to his boxing skills, like you mentioned earlier, you know. And a lot of times, even when a fighter like Austin Trout, when he fought, you know, his last fight, which we were talking about, and I just forgot the name right now. It just flew out of my head for some reason. But Anyways, I know.
I hate when that happens.
There was no adjustment, really.
Yeah.
You know, it was basically he stayed to his game plan, and he kept doing what he does best.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm a bit afraid of, is that Austin, he tends to fall into that. He could stay himself. And with a fight like this, and in this magnitude, with a fight with a guy that can adjust, we've seen Miguel kind of adjust. You know, I mean, he could have been blown out a lot quicker by Manny Pacquiao, but he made some adjustments. He understood, hey, I'm getting beat. This guy's touching me a lot more than it needed to be, so I need to kind of get on my bicycle here. He did that, even with the rematch with Antonio Margarito. He got on his bicycle. He's a disciplined guy, very disciplined. We saw what he did with Floyd Mayweather. So that's the thing. The faces of what Miguel can do. Can Austin change his expression? Can he change his face? Can he change his attitude? It's a very interesting fight. We want to patch in some fight fans. Fight fans, call in 347-215-7598. Certainly can. Let's talk some Miguel Cotto and Austin Trout. Or let's talk about his upcoming weekend fights, Rios and Alvarado. But anyways, let's go back to the thought of Mr. Gabriel Montoya, who's going to throw out what he thinks.
On Rios Alvarado, you know, I don't think it's that, you know, there's no mystery to the fight, you know, except for maybe that Alvarado has, like Rio said, he's kind of intimated that he might try some different tactics. He might box a little bit. I think he has, because he's got the size, he's got the length, he can kind of do that. And he boxed a little bit more in the Herrera fight. I think he understood what he needed to be and that he couldn't just go right out there and be, you know, completely overly aggressive. Or a guy like Herrera could tire you out and make you miss a lot, particularly in close and make you pay. But he was able to hang with that against Prescott. He was getting outboxed. He was getting beaten to the punch. But he was able to get his work in, get to the body. And late, he was able to adjust and just go for it and get that stoppage. That's a special gear. Rios, he's seen adversity against Miguel Acosta. He was hurt early. The speed was a bit of a problem. He was getting the same thing, beaten to the punch, out-quicked. He started to adjust. Boom. He kicks it into another gear, and he takes out Acosta. That's special. But he hasn't looked good in a couple fights while, you know, Alvarado is coming off those Prescott and the Herrera fights where he's looking better and better. It's I don't think one side or the other really equals, like, this guy's going to win or that guy's going to win. I just have a feeling that the physicality, the size, the nature of the fight, and that Alvarado might be able to box just enough in spots that he does more damage without taking too much from the smaller guy in Rios. And I think he stops him late. I think it's that kind of fight where it's just brutal punishment. The stoppage late, though, with it being 10 rounds, maybe not. If it was 12, I'd be real confident on the stoppage late.
I don't know, man. I think it's going to be a midway stoppage. But let me ask you this. Yeah, I do. But let me ask you this, though. What is the prediction of how many jabs are going to be thrown per guy? Or if any?
None.
You know, I think that maybe that first round, I think they are going to jab just to kind of figure out the measurement and the distance. And then as soon as they find each other, you know, I think that the trick-or-treating is going to come early. We're going to see a lot of treats out of this fight, man. I'm excited about this fight. I think it's a great fight, you know. Going with Nonito Dornier, man, really quick, what do you think? What's your thoughts? And seeing what the past we've seen Nonito not making adjustments. He's kind of almost fell in love with his power punching. He's, you know, he sometimes tends to admire his work, and he's kind of sometimes stays in that pocket. What's your thoughts?
You know, I've been watching a lot of the Rafael Marquez fight with Nishioka.
Nishioka, yep, with Rafael. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and he looks, you know, he's very economical. He's a classic boxer. He even described himself as a pure boxer, or not a pure boxer, but mainly a boxer is what how he described himself. And I would agree with him. But he does have some power. He is, you know, he took out Johnny Gonzalez 3 rounds.
Yeah.
You know, which is pretty surprising. It can be sudden. He can be very aggressive, and he can go toe-to-toe. The thing that really interested me about him, and after watching that fight, you know, he kind of got bloodied, and he kind of corrected me. I thought it was his ear that had damage to it, but he's like, no, it was like top of my head that bled down that way. And I was like, you know, Rafael Marquez is kind of old, and you're going the distance, and not life and death, but you're going a little tough with him. But he hasn't fought since then. You know, that's his last fight. That was a year ago. That was last October. And the thing that really struck me was that he knew all along that this was the only fight he wanted, was Nonito Donaire. And he's had to wait a couple fights. He had to wait a whole year to get the fight. But, you know, he originally, Montiel had called him out when I think it was the end of 2011. Or 2010. He was the end of 2010. He was Japan's Fighter of the Year, and there they played like a video challenge from Fernando Montiel to Nishioka, and then Montiel went off and got knocked out by Donaire in the meantime.
Right.
So Donaire kind of represents the thing that he lost, was that big American fight, you know, a network fight where he could have been Donaire. So he's prepared only for Donaire for an entire year. That's got to count for something. That makes him really
scary.
Dangerous. Yeah, it's really dangerous to me.
When you talk about him being economic in his punches. You know, the one thing I saw with the Marquez, even with the Gonzalez fight, is that his timing is really good. He allows you to you know, he'll catch some of your punches, but then he waits for you to take that step back, and then he throws his left. And his left is really precise, and it's well-timed. He steps his lead leg out, which he closes that distance when you're taking that step back. And that's really hard to do, is to time a guy who's going to throw their punches and take a step backwards, because what they're really doing is taking that step back so that when you throw a punch, they're out of range. He makes sure that he gets himself in that range. That's exactly what he did with Johnny Gonzalez. He made sure he was in that range. He clipped him, and he dropped him. Same thing with Marquez. You know, Rafael Marquez, he did a lot of that counter shot that sometimes I think, in my opinion, it's going to get Nonito in trouble.
You know, he is technically sound. That's the thing. I flip it over and –
But
you know, Rob,
dropping is just bad. I got to tell you that. Watching, you know –
Donaire with all the holes that he's got with his wild style. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about Nishioka. He likes to drop his hands, you know. He likes to kind of flirt with you to kind of sucker you in. I'm not sure if you want to do that.
Well, he said specifically he's looking for Donaire's left hook. So I think he's going to be protecting against that. Because, you know, I mean, that's a great weapon against a southpaw. A lot of people, I talked about this in my article today. Most people think that the right-handed guy is at a disadvantage against a southpaw. And that really isn't true. Anybody that faces a southpaw is at a disadvantage, only in the fact that they rarely anybody faces southpaws. You don't find them on a regular basis. You don't prepare for them on a regular basis. But really, in terms of like the technical part of it, if you really think about it, by being opposite, you're putting your jab actually closer to the guy. Each guy's jab becomes much closer, that lead hand, by turning the shoulder that way. And really all it is it becomes a footwork battle. The right-handed guy is going to try to push towards his left or circle around to his left to set up his angle, and the southpaw is going to be moving to his right to do the same thing. And it becomes, you know, basically you end up both kind of moving in the same direction. You know, with regular guys, you can kind of move around. You're both trying to move towards the left. It's a different kind of battle. So I think, you know, when he's got that left hook in mind, because that's a great weapon up front to use on a southpaw, Nonito's going to have to deal with that right hook coming back also.
Yeah.
You know, and it's also going to open up, if Nonito is going for the headshot with the left hook, it's going to open up a really hard punch for a southpaw to always land, unless it's a counter while you're ducking under, which is the right hook to the body. It's not the same kind of weapon that an orthodox guy can rely on, that left hook to the body. For southpaws, especially when you're facing the opposite guy, it's kind of tough. It's not a punch you rely on. You do that straight left to the body. That's what's open. This fight's got a lot of a guy that's going to tame Donaire is going to be a technical guy, and Nishioka is that guy. The thing I wonder about him, and the Marquez fight tells me this, is the legs.
Right.
I don't know if they can keep up with Nonito.
That's the thing, too. But the thing with Nonito is, I go back again, is that he, with the speed, with that advantage of speed, he's kind of left his old style, which is being a counterpuncher. He's there to be hit.
Right.
And you know, it's one of those, you know. But really quick, I want to go back here, to kind of mention one of the, you know, when people are talking to us on Twitter and stuff, and Fight Source saying Mike actually jabs a lot, and I watched the Cesar Balzon, and
I was actually kidding about no jabs, but
yeah. Now I was gonna say, though, this is my thing, was that okay. I know he jabs a lot, you know, but a lot of times he jabs to kind of find you. You know, and with Prescott, he jabbed to find him and stuff. Where this time around, is he really going to need a jab to find Rios? He's going to be there to be hit. You know, that was the thing that we were just kind of throwing out there. But
you know, I think there'll be jabs. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a guy living on his jab. I think the jabs are like entry points. You know, I expect to actually see more jabs from Alvarado in this fight. I think if anybody's going to rely on that as a hard weapon, it's going to be him.
I think it's going to be the adjustment, you know what I mean, where he tees off and then it's using that jab again to get back to set himself back up again, to get that set. A lot of, you know, they don't necessarily use the jab to utilize it to kind of create openings, but they do utilize it by resetting themselves so they can throw their hard punches behind it, you know. That's a tactic that we've seen plenty of times from hard punchers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's man, I cannot wait for that fight. Both fights really, because it, what this fight does is the card satisfies the full palate.
Right.
You know, you got your classic boxing fight, and then you've got just an all out war that's about to break out. I think we're going to be a little tired sitting there watching it live, because you know, I'm probably going to get there early, you know, for the prelims, obviously, but. I mean, I think that Rios Alvarado, if you're right, I mean, it's going to be like a sprint towards the middle of the fight and a stoppage. And then, you know, Donaire Nishioka, it's like listening to a bunch of punk rock and then turning on Beethoven afterwards, you know, and then seeing how that works. It's going to be more of a classic fight, I think, more of a chess match, guys trying to figure each other out. The thing that worries me about Donaire is that, like, he has Robert Garcia in his corner, but that's not like the guy that works with him all through camp. He has two other
right.
men that work with him. And condition him, and I just
never really like when fighters do that. You know,
no,
to me it's an overload. Yeah, exactly. It's just an overload of information. You know, it's you got to build a trust. There's got to be a trust system with your fighter and your trainer. You know, you got three guys. You know, chirping in the ear. Who does he listen to? There's a lot of confusion, especially if the other guy is adjusting and doing his ring generalship and he's taking over. That can be distressful, disturbing, and confusing.
Yeah. I think we're ready for Stephen. We have Steve Kim coming on at 7 and Stephen Fetter. It's like a evening of Steve's coming on here at 6:30. Who's the manager of Latif Coyote. I'm really curious what his reaction is to what Tarver had to say. At the hearing, I don't know if he listened to the whole thing, but
I'm curious about how his reaction is. How Tarver basically was like, "Come on, you know me, you know, I wouldn't have done this, you know, I'm a commentator, etc." You know, about his reaction, how Showtime just kind of threw him aside. Really, realistically, we have never really spoken about that being let go by Showtime as a commentator, which he was doing really good with. Is that justifiable? Should he have been let go based on the reasons of the test?
That's an interesting question. Well, I mean, he lost several things. He lost there was a book deal that was in the works that pretty much got put on hold. He was supposed to be the Olympic commentator. Instead, we got BJ Flores, We would have had Antonio Tarver for the Olympics. That's how that deal happened. So that went away, and then the Showtime gig went away. I'm not sure if it's permanent, but I think it's like for a period of while he's suspended. I'm not sure what the terms of the deal, but yeah, I mean, and on top of it, he's like, my name's been ruined. You know, I went all this way, and at the very end of it, I got popped for steroids. That's kind of, you know, I'm not going to say it's unfair. What's in your system is really your responsibility. And if you're not in control of that, well, that's not my problem. That's your problem. What he was taking, you know, Dristanolone, that drug is used as a cutting drug by or during the cutting phase for bodybuilders. But it still promotes testosterone growth. It just does it in a way that doesn't maintain a lot of water.
I don't think he knew how to use it right, man, when he got in with
Well, that's one of the things he did was point. He had like photos. He's like, look at my picture. You know,
right.
Do I look like a guy on steroids? I'm not all ripped up. I'm not. Yeah, but that's not what that drug does. It helps you during the weight cutting phase to still maintain testosterone, still maintain your strength and recovery and all that stuff. I don't think the panel understands the drug. I don't think they're that advanced, but I think they know a guy that has a drug in his system who doesn't really have a defense when they see one. And he didn't. It was, like you said, it was like, come on, you guys. Like, his bad left hook hit it. You know, come on, guys, it's me. Come on. You know?
You got anything else left to say tonight? No, any excuses?
Yeah, you had excuses tonight? Apparently he didn't. Tarver had no excuses.
Right.
It was just it was brutal. You know, I felt bad for him because it was interesting because Howard Jacobs, he's a top anti-doping lawyer. He helped Berto. He was with the guy that was having a hearing beforehand where his sample cup was they were questioning the chain of custody. He tested positive for stanozolol. He was an MMA fighter. And Howard Jacobs, it was beautiful watching professionals work. This guy was really attacking the chain of custody and how it all works. And they screwed up the paperwork, and they might have used the same cup. They like didn't get enough urine the first time, so they like poured it out the next day and then used
right.
the same. It was just an absolute mess. It just shows the CSAC, the California State Athletic Commission, at their finest. But then he was also the lawyer for Tarver. And there it was like he kind of argued for a while. Like that case went on for a long time, the first one. Tarver's didn't go on that long. You know, he made his statement. They kind of went back and forth a little bit. They were like, look, we're not asking for the full lifting of the ban or the suspension, but, you know, just like 6 months or something. And the commission just wasn't having it.
Right.
You could see, you know, just by the way Jacobs was working, which case was stronger, you know? It was like, all right, we tried. Let's just get out of here, you know? Whereas the first one, when they ruled to uphold the suspension, he still kind of went after people. Like, wait a minute, you guys actually screwed up. Like, if this is the court of law, like, I'd get this thing thrown out just on the paperwork alone.
Right.
Still see him fighting. But with Tarver, it was like, all right, peace. So, I don't know. It was an interesting case. I'm curious to see what Steven has to say.
I give him a thumbs up. You know, an A for effort of trying to get himself out of the suspension. And, you know, at the same time, too, a livelihood, you know. It's does the punishment fit the crime to take away completely his livelihood of making any money to survive? I'm not sure. I'd like to hear what Steve definitely what his thoughts and what he thinks. You know, being in the position he's a manager and he manages fighters, how would he have dealt with one of his fighters if they were in that same similar situation? So
yeah, I mean, well, I guess like Steve Kim said, and we'll have him on later, but it's a matter of, how about not get fat in between fights and, like, fight at your leisure, you know? You made $1 million for the Coyote fight. Is that a $1 million fight to you, you know? I mean, I guess these guys, you know, he's got a name. But I was there. His name didn't sell a lot of tickets.
Right.
It wasn't an event. It was kind of dreary. It was not it was memorable in that it was unmemorable. And it was a fight that I didn't really care to see again. So, I mean, I guess for Coyote, on his part, he'd probably want that rematch to right the wrong. I mean, for them, you know, these guys fight for pride as well as money a lot of the time. But I don't know if I have a lot of mercy for that. He only got fined like $2,500, so the fine didn't reflect any sort of danger. It's more of the suspension.
Right.
the death sentence, but I mean, you know, it ruins his good name, but, you know, don't have drugs in your system. How about that? Don't get fat and play golf all year and then go, you know what? I want to get out from behind the commentating booth and go fight.
Brutal.
You know, either you're a fighter or you're... Is that rude? I mean,
no. I kind of agree with you on that. I do. I really do, you know. I honestly thought that the punishment did fit the crime. I agree with you all the way. I'm wondering what other folks think. What's their thoughts about that, you know? And we're going to talk some more boxing here. We're going to begin in our next interview calling in a short bit. And we're going to start talking about Broner versus DeMarco. It's going to be a hell of a fight. It's happening in November. You got your puncher versus your speedster. You know, we love fights like that. If anytime we think of a certain fight like that, we think of Melvick Taylor versus Julio Cesar Chavez. And to me, this is a very huge step up for both men. There's a lot of stake to this here. I could think of a number of reasons why the fight shouldn't have happened, but I'm glad that it did happen, Gabriel.
Oh yeah, this is a sweet fight. I mean, I still contend that I don't think anybody's going to physically challenge Broner until he gets to 140 at least. But at the same time, I think the skills of DeMarco, he's very motivated right now. He's on a hot streak, and he really believes in himself. And I think that's a huge component. Ponce de Leon brought that to the table.
Yep.
And I really haven't seen a fighter since with Broner. I guess Escobedo brought that to the table as well, but I think everything that happened...
I don't know if he did.
He got a little bit shell-shocked at all that happened. You know, he kind of like realized, well, I'm just going to pay it, you know.
I don't know if he did. Honestly,
yeah.
I going back with that fight, I just didn't see
the
confidence.
By the time he got to the ring is all I mean. I think going in he had confidence, but the time all that shit went down and he got in the ring, it was a different story. DeMarco's going to bring a belief to win. I hope, unless, you know, Broner misses weight and they pay him off too.
Well, you know, here's the thing though. Even missing weight, I don't think that's going to be a huge factor because DeMarco is not a small guy too at 100. You know, in his division, he's a guy too that can pack on some pounds. He's a guy too that can come in a little heavier in the ring. In terms of how is Broner? I mean, if there's anything, Broner's really got to bring in his skill level and keep it up to par. You know, there's no messing around because he's got a guy that can thump. And when you got a guy that can thump, and you've seen what he's been able to absorb and give out, dish out, you have to be in the top of your game. Because if Broner thinks he's going to be able to stop DeMarco, he's in for a rude awakening. Really rude awakening. And if he thinks he can allow DeMarco to turn up the heat and he can take the punches, he's again, he's in for a rude awakening. So he's got to be in the top of his game. I'm not really sure if he wants to come in as heavy as he did with Escobedo. He was facing Escobedo, who was a solid guy, but really a small guy, a small frame fighter. DeMarco, to me, is a much more bigger frame guy, more solid, more heavier, and obviously the much heavier-handed person stepping in the ring.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the problem. It's just the physicality. Like I said, you know, I think he should be able to absorb the punishment of DeMarco. It's going to be the technical skills, the stance of him, the way he's able to get off to the side. He's a guy that really knows how to elongate. You know, he's not afraid to have that really long jab. Look at the way what he landed on Molina. It was a long range 1-2 that got him going. He caught him on the end of his power. He knows how to throw it to disguise that rear shot. Those are things that you know, like I've always looked at like Mayweather. I remember like Doug Fisher was the first guy to really say this to me. He's like, everybody thinks it's the pressure fighter, Mexican guy that's going to jack Floyd up. He's like, he'll eat that guy up all day.
Right.
It's going to be the straight punching, technically skilled guy that really comes down the middle. That's going to be it. And he's exactly right. And I think DeMarco, while physically he may not be able to handle him, technically wise, he's going to be able to give him a lot of trouble. But, you know, it could end up looking like Josecito versus Saul Alvarez. You know,
but here's the thing, too, though. Here's the thing, too, though, is that a lot of times that a lot of these fighters, you know, when they do – a Mexican fighter does face a speedster, it's their very first time facing a speedster. It's the very first time they're actually up against a guy that got – that has fast hands. You know, DeMarco, this is not going to be his first time. He's not. This is not new territory. You know, the only thing that's going to be new with him is that he's basically facing the most skilled level fighter he's ever faced in his career. But with hand speed, I'm not really sure. We got our next guest on the line. We're going to patch him in here on Leaving the Ring. Fight fans, you want to call in 347-215-7598. Tell us who you think has the upper hand here, Broner or DeMarco. Let's get Steve. Steve, what's up, brother? You're on live right now on Leaving the Ring.
Hey guys, how are you? What's going
Doing
on?
Doing great, man. Thank you very much for coming on and speaking to
What's
us
up,
here.
Man?
The manager of Coyote Latif. Hey, let me ask you, did you have a chance to watch the Ustream of the commission, the CSAC, with Antonio Tarver?
No, I didn't see it. I just got the call about the results, you know. I didn't actually see what happened during it, but I just got the results from it.
Let me ask you about the result. What was your thoughts about it? Were you opposed to it? Were you saying, well, you know, that was good enough, or should it have been a much more severe punishment?
Well, I mean, it's kind of crazy in that you know, first of all, you have a fine of $2,500 against a guy that made $1 million for a fight. That in itself is so. It's the same fine that you would have gotten if you were, you know, a guy tested positive for smoking marijuana, you know,
right.
a drug that's not going to be an enhancement drug. So the banned substance penalty that they have to evaluate what the situation is and apply the right penalty. The suspension itself, you know, being suspended for a year out of boxing, I think the tarnish on his career is worse, obviously, than anything.
The
thing is, his age, is he going to be able to come back really and, you know, and bounce back from this? It ruined him much worse outside the ring than it did in. But it is a joke when you have somebody that's just made $1 million. I mean, in Vegas, at least they have the chance to really hit the purse. In this situation where they have a cap of $2,500, it's crazy. But as far as the result of it, I mean, you know, I think it's another, you know, bad bump for boxing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, our sport is not like, you know, it's not different from any other sport. Lots of athletes are, you know, are taking, you know, enhancement drugs. Lots of athletes get caught in other drugs or other sports. But, you know, we obviously focus on it because it's the sport we follow. But it's not a, you know, we're not alone out there on this.
I agree.
Yeah,
I completely agree. But you think that the mind frame of that punishment of $2,500 and the ban was, well, we banned him and his name is tarnished. He's been taken away for the commentary. He's lost the book deal. He's lost this. He's lost that. That alone was money that was in the bank that obviously is never gonna see the vault.
I mean, the thing is, you know, if I want to, you know, I'm obviously a Latif's manager, so I'm gonna come from the different side of it, but
right.
You know, my guy trained the same way he did. My guy did it without the aid of the drugs. He doesn't make anywhere near what Tarver got. Tarver gets to keep his money. At the end of the day, that was a pretty good change he made. You know, you can look at it that way and say, well, why shouldn't that be at least a penalty? You know, why shouldn't that be something of a greater hit? But I actually like Antonio. I think he's a really good guy. I've never had a bad experience with him. I respect him. I think he did a really good job working on Showtime. So I feel bad for him, honestly. I don't want to see any guy not get a chance to take care of his family and you know, do the job that he's gifted in. So I'm sure like he has paid a big price for this, you know.
So
I don't have an issue. I don't have an issue. I just think in general, it has nothing to do with Antonio Tarver. I think in general, a $2,500 fine for a title fight, when you're caught taking something like the, you know, any kind of banned substance, you know the rules, you know. If you're making that kind of money, the California Commission should definitely look into saying it should be a percentage of the purse, and that's simple as that. Make it a rate, a flat percentage against the purse, and that's it. You know.
What do you think about? And hey, Steve, how you doing? This is Gabe Montoya.
Hey,
I'm doing good, man. For me, the one that gets me, and I'm in agreement with you, and you can't help but not feel compassion for Tarver. I really like him as a commentator. I thought he was probably one of the best guys out there, and just seems like a good guy. But the bottom line is, you know, that drug was in his system. But marijuana,
and Chavez Jr., and everybody's kind of vilifying him for that. Do you think that's more of a sign of laziness, and it shouldn't be looked at as a – or like a disrespect for the sport, as opposed to being looked at as a performance enhancer?
Well, you know, remember a long time ago there was a thing with Charles Barkley, and he said, look, you know, I'm not going to be an ambassador to the sport, you know. And, you know, a lot of these guys, they can understand it. It's a job, you know, and they don't really want to be put on a pedestal. They don't want to be looked up to other than what it is that they do in the ring or they do on the court or anywhere else. But at the end of the day, you know, they can say that all they want, but they are put on a pedestal and they are looked up
right.
to. And, you know, that is part of the responsibility. And I think that what happened with Julio is, you know, you live a charmed life, you know, and I think that, you know, you feel at some point there's an empowerment that you can get away with just about anything. And I don't think it's anything that he's, you know, he's not a belligerent kind of guy. It's not like something that I think he did, you know, consciously. It just became part of his routine. That doesn't make it right. It makes it, you know, if anything, it makes it wrong. But it's a disrespect more so not to the sport. It's a disrespect for himself because he carries that name with him regardless of the fact that I think he's done a good job of trying to create his own career away from his dad, which is a big, you know, it's a big hurdle to get past. But he yells it to himself. He yells it to his family. Not, you know, you don't do that. And then on top of that, the sport. And then third, you don't do it to your coach. You know, you don't do it to Freddie Roach, who stood there and was there for you and your team and your strength coaches, everybody that's behind you. You owe it to your team. You owe it to Bob Arum. You owe it to everybody that's made sure that you've had this career to not do that kind of stuff. And it's just, it's crazy. You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
I agree.
Yeah, it's I mean, you know, he was having trouble sleeping, you know, and after the beating that he took,
yeah.
I understand why.
yeah, I mean, you know, what
if
I mean,
that was
I mean,
coming to me,
yeah,
I would be yeah. rolling and tossing and turning.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get it. You know, you got a big fight coming up, and you go, you know what? I can train or I can smoke a doobie. I don't know. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
So
I'll smoke a doobie.
Yeah, I think I'll smoke a doobie and go play some back rack. Okay.
That's exactly. The California in me. And I actually kind of like that Bob Arum's been pretty open about it. Like, look, you know, I don't think it should be illegal. I don't think it should be, you know, on the banned list. It's not a performance enhancer. And I saw like Robert Morales, I don't know if you read his column. He talked to, I think it was him, he was talking to Kaiser about, Keith Kaiser from the Athletic Commission in Nevada.
Yeah.
About it. And Keith just, I'm like, dude, have you ever smoked a joint in your life? Like, you need to just give him a joint and like,
you relax, man.
Yeah. It's not for anything other than making art and making love. That's how I look
yeah.
at it.
Yeah, or getting fat. In my case, you know, the last time I did it was like in 19, like, I don't know, 81 or something. All I remember was I wanted to eat the refrigerator. So, you know, if for me... For me, it never did anything. I just maybe, you know, fall out and eat. That's it. So I never. But, you know, the thing is, though, it's funny. Like, Bob's point is right, obviously. It's like, you know, that's the big question. I mean, should it be legal? Should it not be legal? Basically, it is legal. I mean, you can go to these, you know, pharmaceutical places and get something that can knock you back worse than anything you can get on the street. But, you know, I think that the issue with that is, though, is that, you know, it's a mindset for the kid, and it, the reflection it has on boxing isn't so much like, hey, you know, it's an athlete, another athlete taking drugs. My issue with boxing is bigger than that, in that, you know, we are in a situation where we're really facing, and we are an archaic sport. You know, we are really archaic. We can, you know, we can fool ourselves all we want. We can convince ourselves what we are all we want. And the fact is, we're behind the times. We always have been. We rely on the big fights a year to keep us going. And we're no, you know, our marketing is nowhere near what the UFC was or the MMA was, you know, in the beginning, even in the early stages. So we need these major fights to keep us going. Now, on top of that, we need young fighters. We need, you know, something that keeps the sport contemporary. Otherwise, we're going to basically be, you know, a sport that caters to mostly, you know, middle-aged guys and up. And, you know, you don't get the young money. Even though there's more affluence in older people, there's actually more spending power with the younger people. So, you know, what are we going to do to keep that going? Well, you got a guy like Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. who's young, good-looking, you know, he's got the crowd behind him. You want to make sure that guy is your ambassador. That's one of your blue-chip guys.
Right.
And that's where we get hurt. And so you can't have fights where Shane Mosley, I love Shane, but you can't have fights where Shane Mosley is carrying some of the weight for the card that night. You know, you can't have fights where, you know, your even Tarver or, you know, or Bernard Hopkins. I mean, think about it. Who is really the ticket guys today? They're guys that are way past the contemporary audience. You know,
right.
The contemporary audience doesn't know who the hell these guys are. You get a kid like Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., he should be doing the Kimmel Show. You know, he should be out there, you know, marketing for boxing. That's your ambassador. That's what I'm talking about, of making it, crossing over to, you know, the same place that Kobe Bryant would walk into. That's where Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. should walk into. Then you start to develop a sport, you know, that crosses over and that, you know, caters to the young and always caters to the older audience anyway. But we need that. That's what we need. Like, I've got, you know, a young kid, Jose Benavides Jr., for instance, you know, that I'm hoping that really has the, you know, the potential to go. And, you
mm-hmm.
know, I see him as a guy who, you know, is not a boxer, but he's an athlete. He's a professional athlete. I always tell my guys, it's entertainment, man. You know, entertainment. You got to know your audience.
Right.
Get out there after the fight. Shake hands. Take pictures. That's what it's about. You know, and that's what we needed with Julio. That's what we need with the young guys. That's what we need from Broner. You know, Maris, any of these guys that are young guys that are out there fighting, they have to have a responsibility. You know, and maybe even some of the bad boys, you know, even the Rios kind of thing where, you know, maybe he represents a different faction or whatever it is. But, you know, he's a gifted fighter. He's a tough guy. But, you know, there's a market for that too. But they have to be in the forefront. And when you have this kind of nonsense, when you're talking about millions of dollars, what is the fate of the guy that's in the gym making nothing? You know, making $3,500 to go get his head banged out for 8 rounds. What does it tell him when the guy
right.
is making millions? That's where the problem is. It trickles down, you know.
Yeah.
So,
do you think
know,
that
not preach, I'm not preaching it. I'm just saying. That's my
right.
Point,
you know?
That's a very valid.
Yeah. Big time. Do you think, though, and that was going to go into my next question with you, is that you think that the PRing has to tighten up a lot more, you know? I mean, for instance, when these guys are busted with getting something in their system, it seems to me the PRing, not just the PRing, but the fighter, which they have every right, they kind of go into the shadows. But the PRing does that too. They go in the shadows when they should be the front. They should be the
yep.
ones out there trying to keep that name together.
Yep.
You think that's one of the biggest problems right now we have in boxing?
Absolutely. Well, there's no real department, you know, that handles that for these. I mean, they say that there is for the promoters, but there's no spin doctor. There's no really, you know, in Hollywood, you know, guy drives his car through the W Hotel. You know, they somehow able to spin that into something positive. Well, he was texting, you know, a donation and for the United Fund when he went to the lobby. You know, I mean, you have to have a guy, you know, so you have to have somebody in place that immediately is there. You know, and the way that works usually in the movie business or something in the entertainment business. You know, usually they're there during the process. So, you know, you don't have a zillion different, reporters coming in and out of the gym. You have that, but then you have your one PR guy who's with you all the way. And he's constantly looking for it if there's any issues, you know, spinning things the right way, putting things in the forefront, you know, putting positive stuff out there. And then if this happened, there should have been damage control right away. And I think they could have. They could have. And Julio would have been a part of that. I think you can't, as much as the guy wants to hide and go into the shadow, like, don't blame him, believe me. I mean, it's embarrassing. I understand it. But, you know, you have a guy who's schooling him at that point, saying, listen, man, we, you know, okay, there's a screw-up, but you got a big, huge career in front of you, okay? So here's what we need to do. You know, here's what we need to say, you know? You know, I mean, there have been guys who, there's been actors who picked up hookers on Sunset Boulevard, and the next week they're on Jay Leno. You know, there's a reason for that. You know,
I mean,
you know?
Charlie Sheen made millions off of it. You know, they used that spinoff, and it's benefited him and stuff. Let me ask you, what would you have done if these scenarios would have happened with one of your fighters? What do you think that would have been the smartest thing for yourself and your fighter to attack right away before the media was able to darken it up even more what it was at the time?
Well, first of all, you know, the behind-the-scenes part is to find out what the root of all this is. You know, you want to know, on a personal side, you want to find out what's going on with the kid. You know, where are we? Why is this happening? What do we do? You know, you want to get him help. You want to make him understand it's not the way you go to sleep at night. This is an issue. This is a problem. You know, you got to kind of really sit down and get them on board. Because the first thing you want to do is make sure it doesn't happen again. And you don't want to make them feel like they've done something wrong. You realize, you just say, look, there's an issue here, you know, and there's other things that are part of this problem. You know, this is just this is not the whole problem. Taking the drug isn't the problem. It's just an ingredient. What's the big picture? So I'm sure there's a lot of stuff going on there for him. But on the outside, the spinning side, I mean, you've got to kind of make him come out in the forefront, as opposed to the more you hide, the more you go away, the more guilty you seem, you know, and the more people think he doesn't really want to face his problems. So I would have them be in the forefront. I'd have them get, you know, a couple of key reporters and make a feature article on it, talk about the situation, break it down, you know, let the audience the come on a show like this, talk about it, say, listen, I made a mistake. You know, this is something and here's why. You know, this is something I did, and I can't ever do this again. I let my fans down. I mean, they have to come out and say it. They have to come out and talk about it.
That's exactly what I was going to talk to you about, too, is that I kind of tend to feel that these fighters hurt themselves a lot more staying in silence and staying in the shadows rather than coming out. When we had Larry O, who was suspended in the UK as a heavyweight, he came on immediately, and he opened up, and the forgiveness from fans was overwhelming. You know, it seemed that they were able to connect with them because they were like, this guy's a human being. To me, when you see guys like Peterson and Berto and even Antonio Tarver, they kind of stay in the silence. And it just kind of, you know, builds up. You know, the story starts to build even more.
Absolutely. And then it's like becomes like a game of telephone where, you know, people kind of come up with their own take on it. And then, you know, you don't really know what the real truth is. It's like, oh, yeah, I heard he said this, or I heard he said that, or I heard he did this. Yeah, you got to come out right away and say something. And, like, you know, Antonio did release a couple of, like, you know, please respect my family. You know, I know he came out with a couple of statements that he said, you know, but frankly, you know, you're a commentator. You're used to being in the public eye. You take, a good 2 weeks off and think about it, put your thoughts together, and then you come out and you make a statement. You call up, you know, your PR guy, and you go on a public venue and you talk about it. You know, you just say, look, you know, I'm waiting for all the – you know, the information to come into me, but, you know, the fact that I'm in the situation at all is really bothering me, whatever. And certainly now that the B test is out, I would have him immediately come out and say something, you know. And,
exactly.
You know, I mean, now that there's no question what happened, and, you know, you don't say, well, I don't know, I have to examine my camp. Listen, nobody sticks, you know, whatever, a needle in your ass and you don't know about it, okay? I mean,
exactly.
You know, something happens. You know, I've never had that happen. I've never had a doctor stick a needle in my ass and me go, was that a needle I just had in my ass? I'm sorry, I didn't know this. But, you know,
I'm going to put this into you. Okay, cool.
Yeah, go ahead,
you know.
Sure. I don't know, you know. I mean,
your point
you made is totally right. Like, Larry's coming out and see, it's a big difference. You know, you start talking about it and people... Because, look, man, I mean, everybody at some point or another did some of this stupidity at some, you know, whatever. It may not have been the exact drug or the exact scenario. Everybody makes mistakes, you know. We were all an analyst at one point. But when you're 43 years old and you're representing, you know, fighting for a title belt, you have to explain to people, you know. You have to come, you know, to be able to step up front and say why you did this, you know. You owe it to your public. You know?
When you talk about it.
Yeah,
right. You know, when you talk about a spinoff, I mean, here's the spinoff of it for Antonio Tarver. He's a household name. A lot of folks know about him. The spinoff should have been, I'm going to be the ambassador of this anti-doping because I didn't know what was in my system, but now I'm going to start getting the bottom of this because if it happened to me, it can happen to anybody. That should have been the spinoff.
Yeah, I mean, you go right for it. You know, you go, exactly, you kind of go right into the eye of the storm and say, you know what, now that I really understand all this stuff, I'm going to really get behind this thing. I'm going to make sure that this doesn't happen to somebody else, you know. And, you know, you don't fend it off. Look, nobody, you know, there's nobody out there who's ever going to believe. Somebody says, oh, I didn't know. I mean, that's just silly. You know, it's just crazy. I mean, there are situations, I know the thing with Peterson, you know, what he was saying, he should have also come right out and, you know, and spoke about it. The thing is, the denial thing doesn't work. It just doesn't. You know, you got to embrace it and you got to be a man about it, and people are going to respect that a whole lot more. You know, it's just tough with for Anthony. It's tough because, you know, Antonio Tarver's situation is you have to look at him and say, you know, he was trying to extend his career that was already overextended. And it's a shame because taking a shot like that just to get maybe another fight or two, you know, it really hurt him in the long run. But I do think he can save himself. Listen, there have been announcers that have done a whole lot worse. I'm trying to think, my God, I love this guy. I totally grew up listening to him do the Knicks. What was the guy that, like, got caught? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Come on, Marl Albert went through this stuff. You thought there's no way he'll ever be back on, you know. Or, you know, even Jim Gray with Pete Rose. I mean, there's been, you know, there's been a lot of flubs. People have done things. Maybe it wasn't drugs. It was the wrong thing to say or some other crazy thing that they've done. People get over it, man. You know, they do. But the more you come out with it.
Society-based, kind of like Christian values, right? That's how we kind of, in some ways, started. And I think it's a cultural thing. I don't know how other cultures are, but America loves apologies. And if you look at the history of drug cases, it's the guys that came out and said, yep, I did it.
Yep.
That we're all good with. It's the guys like Mosley that still kind of try to pull the wool over our eyes, even though we've all seen that video. Those are the guys that we're always going to be like, yeah, cool to them. But then they walk away and we don't quite feel great about it. And I think Tarver, if he came out and said, you know, I did it, at least Peterson, the way he came out and was, you know, I think people are willing to forgive him, even though I'm still trying to figure out when he's going to have a licensing hearing, because he came out and said, you know, he didn't have to tell us about having it in his system for Khan. He didn't have to talk so freely about it. And he did an interview with me with his doctor, and they talked freely about it.
Had at least the medical. I mean, he had that. He could go off of that. Like, he had the medical issue. You know, he had.
Right.
The, I mean, I could. Yeah. I really didn't. Honestly, I didn't have a hard time with that whole thing with him. I kind of felt bad for him in that, and I didn't really question it that much because he did come out and talk about it. And I said, you know what? That's possible. You know, I mean, it really is. In fact, I was talking to Lem Satterfield. He said to me, he said, you know. He was talking about how, you know, you take medications and stuff for things and you don't know what's in your system. He says, and, you know, you don't realize that some of these drugs that you're taking to save your life or to do, you know, to do something positive for you could have a lasting effect. You don't know how long it's in your system. You know, things like that I can totally understand. I mean, you have to be somewhat compassionate with these situations as well. I mean, these are, this is somebody's life, this is their career, you know. But you're
right. We're also asking them to do something hardcore, like you're saying, like inhuman. They're taking punishment from other guys for money, and athletes aren't getting smaller and slower. They're getting bigger, stronger, faster. So,
right. Yep.
Even as the you know, the drug guy or whatever, as people would look at me for the stuff I've written, I always have thought about that and said, you know, do we need to legalize and regulate it? Do we need, how do we really approach this?
It just has to be an even playing field. I don't condone it because I don't want high school kids taking this crap because they don't know what they're doing. They're not going to go to a doctor and do it the right way. They're going to, you know, they're going to take it, there have been deaths because of it. I don't condone it for that reason. I don't think what happens is if you can say to me, everybody that takes it's going to be monitored, I'd say, okay, well, then it's a person's decision what they do with their body. A guy wants to, you know, push his athletic ability by taking it, puts his, you know, his life at risk, is down the road. But it's his call, and I understand the pressure of performing as a professional athlete. But
absolutely,
it's the people around him, the kids that watch him, will do it without being monitored. That's where you have a problem. But it's either an even playing field where everybody, you know, you just go, okay, well, everybody's on it. You know, I mean, everybody's on it, or everybody could be on it up to this level. Or you have to keep it clean, which is what we're trying to do.
Tough deal, you know what I mean? Regardless, you're playing with your health, you're playing with the other person's, even if it's a playing field, I think there's still a lot of gray areas there. Edwin Rodriguez, La Bomba, who was on a little earlier, I think he said it perfect. He said, you play baseball, you play basketball, you play football, you don't play boxing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think at some point, you know, you have to kind of draw the line and say, I mean, look, the one thing about boxing is like no other sport. I mean, you're, like you said, you're asking for guys to do something that, you know, that nobody else would be willing to do. It's as dangerous as professional football is. You're not going in there, and you might get a concussion playing football, but you're not going in there to try to actually cause a concussion. You know, that's not your sole goal. And the other thing is, you remember, we're feeding off a system. Every other professional sport just about feeds off the educational system. The boxing does not. So you have guys that are in a completely different place, you know, in life, and this is more of a sport that is less about choice. You know, this is kind of, most boxers say, this is what I do. You know, there's nothing else I want to do or could do. So you're dealing with people already that are, their backs are against the wall, their choices are a lot less than the average athlete. So they're going to reach out if they have to get the edge, you know. And
absolutely.
You know, and you know, I don't blame anybody for doing these things. I just have to say you have to be willing to take pay the consequence, and the consequence is just not worth it. That's the problem. You know, I get the human nature of it. I understand the decision process of doing it. I just don't think it's worth it. You know,
I agree.
I do think, you know, I do think we need to step it up, and the more guys we catch, I think eventually guys will stop taking it, and we'll have even fights for the, just the way it was supposed to be, you know. So, you know, I do feel bad, though, about all these. I feel bad about anybody that gets caught like that and, you know, takes away the option for them, you know. But we do tell them, don't do it, you know. I also think strength coaches owe it to their athletes to be much more honest about things. They need to be, the strength coaches themselves need to be more educated. A lot of guys
couldn't agree
there,
more.
You know,
couldn't agree more. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
well, these gyms should be restricting guys who come in. You know, a guy puts a towel on his shoulder or a stopwatch around his neck, and all of a sudden he's a strength coach or a trainer because he can work the pads. I mean, that, you know,
or not. Some of these guys can't work the pads anyway, and they're still. I mean, I've never seen a sport where you're put in the corner to protect somebody like a cut man, for instance. A cut man should go through a rigorous test before he gets a license.
Yes.
I mean, how could you go to the corner and pay $50 and you're now the cut man? I mean, it's crazy.
The sport has always reminded me of the entertainment industry. I did, you know, theater for a long, long time, and it's the exact same thing. You run across as many shitty boxers, trainers, managers, promoters. You know, this sport, you do bad actors, directors, producers in that industry. It's because it, from the outside, when it's done well, it looks like anybody could do it.
Right.
And then and then you go in there and you do it, and it's just it's
a great analogy. It's true. It's like I go into get my dry cleaning, and my dry cleaner's a screenwriter and a quasi producer, and you know he's an actor on the side, and you know I'm like glad I put all the time and effort into this thing, you know.
But imagine your dry cleaner, you know, they give him $30 million to make a movie. You
know? right. What's his name? The guy that backed one of those Travolta films was a dry cleaner. Ely Samurai or something his name was. It was Franchise Pictures. He owned that company. That's what he did. He owned the dry cleaning business. And he's the one that put all that Scientology movie.
Owning one and working in one are two completely different things.
Listen, nobody works in a dry cleaner unless they either own it or somebody in their family owns it, okay? You don't go in there and go, hey, you know what? I can work somewhere. But, yeah, I think I'll work in a dry cleaner. That sounds good. No, that's not an option that ever comes up in someone's mind. That's all family, man. Come on.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's very true.
Yeah.
Well, Steve Kim's going to kill us if we don't get him on. He's our next guest.
Let's purposely keep talking. Come on, let's talk him out. No, I'm kidding. All right, man. Well, listen, guys, thanks so much for having me on. Just real quick, I want to do a shameless plug to tell everybody that Jose Benavides Jr. is fighting Saturday night at Home Depot Center. It's his first 8-round fight, so this is going to be exciting for us. Big step
up.
And then November 3rd, we've got Jamie Cavanaugh fighting at the Hangar in Orange County, 8 rounds, and co-main event on Telefutura. And then December 6th, Ray Beltran opening fight on ESPN. And December 8th, Wally Omotoso fighting on Manny Pacquiao undercard. So we got a busy guys. Everybody's in the ring working in the next couple of months, and real proud of my guys. So thanks for having me on, man. Appreciate it, guys.
There you go.
That is awesome.
Hey, thanks. Thanks a millions. This was a great interview. Love to have you on. Anytime you feel like coming on, you're more than welcome just to call in, chop it up, or else we'll just schedule it with you again.
Oh, no, it's cool. That's really great. Thanks for the open invitation. I appreciate it. All right, guys, have a great night.
You too.
All right, man. I'll see you at the fights.
All right. Okay, yeah, absolutely. Right. See you there.
All right. Take care.
There we go. Steve Fader with us here on Leaving Ring, manager of Lotif Coyote and Jose Benavides Jr., who has a lot of promise here. I love the honesty out of guys that are in the business. You know, we get guys that come on, they try to be more politically correct and stuff. But Steve was just like, hey, I'm going to let it loose. And some of the stuff he had, educational.
Yeah. I like his takes. You know, Steve's always a good guy to run into the gym and start talking to him. You know, and he'll sit there and just talk for like an hour, you know, just about the sport. He loves the sport. You know, that's why he's in it.
Absolutely. And what I'm trying to do right now is
call our next guest.
We're going to call in our next guest as soon as I find the number. Oh, there it is. All right. Hold on. Yeah, really good interview. I mean, I liked everything he had to say. I like that he acknowledges the PR in boxing sometimes. There's a certain lack about it, you know? And
a certain, yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's sorely, you know, it just seems like sometimes they just throw some glitter on it, you know? Or like, you know, they just kind of maybe put up some cheap party favors instead of really,
even,
like, promoting, you know?
It's funny, too, because you even have certain, you know, PRs, or if that's what they want to call themselves, where they shell up, too, as well. When you try to ask us something that's going on, and there's fighter that they represent, they have they're real blunt of just not even responding. There's not even, like, you know, hey, we're not doing that right now. There's just a complete silence, you know? And that's what leads to these bad stories. That's what leads to the assumptions sometimes that these PRs just kind of realize is that your job is to PR.
Hello?
Steve, what's up, brother? This is Dave Buenas and Gabriel Montoya, Leaving the Ring Radio. How you doing, brother?
And gentlemen, how are you? Glad to be on with you.
Doing good, man. Glad to have you on, like always. Let's get down to it. Let's talk about these fights that are happening this Saturday, Steve. What's your take? What do you think? What do you think about the outcome for the headliner with Nonito Dornier? Do you think that there's going to be a change-up? They're talking about him going back to the way he fought before, prior, and he's not going to be falling in love in his power. Do you think that a guy right now in this stage of his career, you think that he's going to fall out of love with his power?
You know, Dave, I think a lot of the way this fight plays out and the way Nonito fights, I think it's really dependent on the Japanese southpaw. I think the book is out on Nonito that if you throw him straight fastballs down the middle of the plate, you can offset a lot of the things he does. I mean, he's what I call a pure fastball hitter.
Right.
You got to pitch around him a little bit. And Narvaez, Wilfredo Vasquez, and then most recently Jeffrey Matubala, I think that they made a conscious decision early in those fights, or maybe even beforehand, what Teddy Atlas would call the silent agreement. You stay away from me, you don't pressure me too much, and I'll be satisfied with getting a moral victory by going to 12 rounds. Well, Montiel, ironically enough, in this sport, the harder you try and actually try to win, it can be the worst off for you. And it's going to really depend on Nishioka. If Nishioka actually comes to fight and to press the action and then gives opportunities for Nonito Dornier, then that'll determine the whole fight. See, Dornier is one of these guys, because of his counterpunching style, where he tries to time you and he hits you with hard individual shots from certain angles with a lot of timing and a lot of target practice that he tries to do,
right,
to sharpshoot you, in essence. If Nishioka decides to just back up and box and be very cautious, guess what, guys? I know what's going to happen, because I know the Mexican fan base out here, and there's going to be a very large crowd. I think what's going to happen is after Rios Alvarado, I think Nishioka Dornier may end up being the walkout bout, because I know a lot of fans by the middle of the round, if this fight is like anything of the past three that Dornier has been involved in, you're going to see a half-empty arena.
You know what? I agree with you on that one here. But here's the thing, though, with Nishioka. It's to me, this is like really honestly for Nonito, in his stage of his career, is actually facing a guy that when it comes to fighting my way, he's actually fighting a guy that's going to fight his way. He's actually fighting a guy that's going to counterpunch, has good timing, who can be very precise. That's a long time since we've seen Nonito fight anybody in that type of stage of a fighter.
If you see Nishioka over a long course of time, and not even the knockout against Johnny Gonzalez, but he's a guy that tries to be offensive in a very smart, safe, professional way. He's in and out with his movement. He'll walk behind a double jab. He has a good straight left hand. You know, he's not going to be target practice for Dornier. I don't think that at all. I think he's going to be very sound fundamentally. I think he'll be careful. I think he'll be responsible in that ring defensively, Dave. However, I do think he will take chances. And I think that's what's been missing from Nonito Dornier, because I've never thought of Dornier as a solid, steady, fundamental fighter. What he is very flashy, and he's very gifted.
Right.
He's a little bit like Roy Jones, and he doesn't necessarily depend on consistency or having a work rate. He relies on timing you and really flashing. And, you know, that's like his nickname, the Filipino Flash, because he hits you like a lightning bolt out of nowhere. But he's not a guy that's going to necessarily chop wood and keep grinding and then tear the redwood down after 10 rounds of hard work to the body. That's not his style. He's a guy that for every 3 minutes of every round, he'll probably work for a good 45 seconds of those rounds. The rest of the time within those segments is really about setting up, almost like a chess player, trying to set up moves two, three moves ahead to kind of lure you in with a combination or some sort of counterpunch. And that's the one weakness of Donaire's style, that even in dominant performances, these fights can devolve into very dull affairs if that other opponent is not willing to be a compliant dance partner.
Yeah, I agree. Big time. Gabe, are you there? Or are you eating?
No, I'm here. I was just, I had to step away for a second. My animals got all unruly. What about the other fight, Steve? I mean, what do you think is the difference between these two guys? Is it going to be size? Is it going to be boxing ability? Heart? Is Rios on the downs, or is he just at 140 rejuvenated, in your opinion?
You know, Gabe, I've actually seen Brandon Rios the last 2 days. You were out with me at the Fortune Gym yesterday, and I was here at the media roundtable at the Fight Hotel in Manhattan Beach. And Brandon Rios looked very good. He's in a very good mood. And a lot of the times you could tell how a fighter is battling the weight just by the way they act. And it's interesting, guys, before I came here to Manhattan Beach, I was actually at the press conference early in the morning at the ESPN Zone, and Brandon Rios felt good enough to actually show up with Robert Garcia for the Brian Valoria Tyson Marquez press conference, because his trainer, Robert Garcia, also works with Vasquez. That shows me something. He's not a guy sequestered in his room. He's not a guy in a sauna. He's not a guy working the elliptical or the treadmill
right.
At the fitness center. That shows me that he's in pretty good physical condition. He seems to be in a very good, light mood. So do I think he's rejuvenated at 140? Well, we're going to find out in about 48 hours. But what I do think is it shows, guys, that the John Murray fight probably should have been the last contest he ever had at 135. And, Gabe, I think me and you kind of agree here. I do think the one issue is Mike Alvarado is the natural 140. And
right.
In fact, seeing him spar last Thursday in the city of Carson at the Rock Gym, guys, he just looks like a welterweight.
Yeah.
He does. If you just look at his frame, you look at the musculature and the thickness throughout the shoulders and back, you almost say to yourself, is this guy a welterweight or a junior welterweight? Well, let's be honest about Brandon Rios. He's moving up from 135 because, quite frankly, his discipline and his lifestyle probably didn't allow him to fight at that weight any longer.
Right.
So for the first time ever, I think Brandon Rios, who I'm a big fan of, is not only facing a guy that may match him in activity, in terms of throwing punches and tempo, but he's also facing a guy that might be bigger and stronger, and I think that's the variable. Does Brandon Rios carry some of that natural strength and heavy-handedness up to junior welterweight?
Well, that was the thing that, you know, he was talking about. It's in my interview that's coming up tonight. He kept saying, I am a natural 140 that had been fighting at 135. But when you look at Alvarado, I'm like, yeah, but he's a natural 147
yeah.
fighting at 140.
40, yeah.
There's the problem. Bottom line, I think it's a good fight.
Well, you know, it's that old saying that they say, it's a double entendre here, but size matters, right, guys?
Yeah.
and I think that is the issue. But another variable here, this is a 10-round fight, and I think that the Rios camp made a stated decision, a concerted decision, to make sure this wasn't a 12-round fight. I think that they wanted a shorter fight because they believe that, hey, if size and strength become a factor, if we indeed are the smaller, weaker individual in that ring, we'd rather be in there for 30 minutes instead of 36. So that's going to be interesting. But also at the same time, Mike Alvarado, for the first time, I think is going to face a guy that's really going to attack that body. And the one thing about Alvarado, he has options, because I've seen Alvarado not only in fights but in sparring sessions where he could basically work off that front side and pump that left jab and actually control things from a distance. I'm not calling him Vernon Forrest, but he can box. I think he can box a little bit more effectively from the perimeter than Rios can. But eventually that temperament, which really makes this a great fight, the temperament of these two fighters, which is so compatible, that eventually this is going to become a phone booth battle. And say what you want about Brandon Rios. He's not the slickest guy, but guys, when he's on the inside chest to chest, he is a very, very skilled infighter, Dave.
Yep. I agree with you 100%. You know, when we were talking about that Mike Alvarado jab, we were talking about that a little earlier, and I was mentioning about the fact of his jab was really mainly used to kind of it was a rangefinder to find these lot lighter and quicker guys for Mike Alvarado. Here, to me, this is more of a jab. If he uses his jab, it's going to be a jab to reset himself, because that's what most big punchers do. They use the jab to reset themselves, to get that range so they can get their punches in between where it can land where it counts, you know. Great, interesting fight. Let me ask you this, though. How much of a agreeance are you when you see a head trainer in the corner of two headline fights at the same time? To me, that just kind of spells destruction in terms of game plans. You know, to me, there's a collision there. I honestly think that when you have two fighters having two big major fights, they should have had different dates, not on the same date, because the concentration obviously has to be split.
Dave, I think that's a very good point. I know for a fact that some of the undercard fights, they are shuffling the order and the amount of rounds, because Robert Garcia is going to be a very busy corner man on Saturday night. He has at least three or four other kids, prospects that Top Rank is moving on this show. And you're right, and they had to move one of the fights back from the one right before television to the second to last, because he needs to wrap hands. That issue is also compounded by the fact that Nonito Donaire and Brandon Rios did not work out in the same area. They did not work out in the same gym. And, Gabe, we've talked about this off there. We know for a fact that I think in 8 weeks, I think me and you have seen Nonito Donaire as much as Robert Garcia. I think as it relates to Brandon Rios, he's a full-time trainer. He's there with them every day at the Robert Garcia Boxing Academy, and he's done a great job in developing him. No argument. As it relates to Nonito Donaire, I get the sense that Robert Garcia is a lot like Angelo Dundee as it related to Sugar Ray Leonard. I don't want to speak ill of the will, because Angelo Dundee was a great boxing personality, but the truth of the matter is, as it related to Ray Leonard, he didn't really train him every day. He kind of met up with him the last week of the fight, while I think Jenks Morton and Dave Jacobs did most of the work leading into the fight. So I think the best way to say it, guys, is that he's a real trainer full-time for Brandon Rios, but when it comes to Nonito Donaire, he is a corner man, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, and I've said this before and I've written it, I do think that the overall development of the fundamental grounding of Donaire, I think, might be hurting, because there's not a teacher there every single day to necessarily hone those tools.
I just hate the fact when you see this, and this is another subject I wanted to bring up, and I'd love to hear Gabriel's take about this one here, is Virgil Hunter been voted Trainer of the Year. He's obviously had great success with Andre Ward, but I hate to see a trainer starting to get their hands on every fighter that's available. Now you're hearing that he's with Angulo all the way down to Amir Khan. To me, that just seems like you spread yourself out too thin, and then you start exposing yourself on the wrongs that you do, because those wrongs don't necessarily, the rights that you're doing with the fighter successful doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate to the other guys.
Well, I don't know. You go ahead, Steve. You're the guest. You take the lead on this question.
Well, I think you're more well-versed because you know Virgil more than I do. But I'll just say this. I think Virgil, with the work he's put in for years with kids like Andre Ward and doing the work he does in Oakland with a lot of amateurs that, you know, just helping kids out, being better young men and enforcing discipline and creating bad good habits in their lives, I think that there's a part of me that says, hey, wait a minute, why shouldn't this guy reap the benefits of his hard work and parlay the results of Andre Ward into more gigs? Because at the end of the day, this is how he pays his bills. And,
right.
You know, no one's ever going to complain. Listen, we all have jobs, and if we can get more paying gigs, we're not turning them down. However, with that said, I do agree with you, Dave. There's a fine line between being in demand and capitalizing on those opportunities to then spreading yourself too thin. Because I do think to a certain degree, and I saw this firsthand, it may have happened to Freddie Roach.
I think more than any writer, yourself, and I think Doug Fisher to an extent, in the early days, you guys witnessed kind of the rise and fall, or I think we're in the decline of that gym in some regards. At least they're on a losing streak right now. They're not about to close or anything. But you've been right there on the front lines of that. I think with Virgil, the way he explained it to me, it's a piece I'm putting out for Boxing News. He's always wanted to put together a stable, and that the old-timers that he apprenticed under always talked about how to put together a stable and how each piece should fit into another. That, you know, he's got Amir Khan, who has trouble with pressure fighters. Well, he's also got an important piece in Angulo, who specializes in being a pressure fighter. Have those two guys work together because Angulo's weakness is speed, you know, in dealing with angles and being outboxed. So he's working with, you know, Fernando Guerrero and Brandon Gonzalez. And I watched it one day where he didn't look that great, and then apparently, you know, the next session I skipped, and apparently he looked good in that session. Several people called me about it, and he starts to adjust. So I think, I don't know if he's so much cashing in. I mean, I think he's cashing in, but I think he's doing it in a very controlled, smart way, because that's just the way Virgil is. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't answer a question without thinking about it for a very long time.
Yeah, I think one thing that's going to be a factor here is that when it's all said and done, his cleanup hitter, his ace in the hole, is Andre Ward.
Right.
And, you know, Andre only fought one time this year. I think that's going to change next year. I expect him to be a little bit more active.
Sure.
They're already talking about a February fight. The name Kelly Pavlik has been brought up prominently for February 23rd. That I think that as it relates to the pecking order and the totem pole of Virgil Hunter, we all know who the number one guy is. That's going to be Andre Ward. And if the other clients that you mentioned, Gabe, are in complete lockstep and understanding that the nucleus of this camp of what Virgil Hunter is Andre Ward, and they can accept that and then handle the logistics of making camps in Oakland or wherever they're going to be and working around Virgil and Andre's schedule, I don't think it's a unreasonable thing for both parties. At the end of the day, I always thought it was unfair that Bowie Fischer, after years of toil and not much money or recognition, I think was basically disallowed by Bernard Hopkins from working with other guys. Listen, trainers have to make a living. Their careers have to go on long after fighters hang up the gloves. And so this is the process of every trainer, though. You apprentice, you're a second assistant, then you start getting fighters, you develop them, and all it takes is that one guy to all of a sudden figure out. And you see, you could have been a trainer, a great trainer, for 25 years.
Right.
Until you get that signature fighter, nobody gives you the credit. And I think Virgil Hunter now says, hey, wait a minute, I think I've cut my teeth, I've proven myself, I have a track record. And I actually want to see this, because the question you have with every trainer that only has that one signature fighter is it the fighter, and how much was the trainer? Now we're going to find out a little bit more because there's a bigger sample size.
Yeah, I think he likes the challenge. That was the other thing he said. He's like, you know, why do anything that's just easy? You know, Angulo represents a challenge. Amir Khan represents a challenge. And I think for a guy like him, getting to know him, I think that's a motivation. Steve, talk to me about, just switching gears really quick, what's going on with Tim Bradley and that whole situation?
Tim Bradley, I think there's much more than his foot, and I believe that there are some complications in the background. And I think Tim Bradley, quite frankly, from what I've been told, doesn't understand his own market value. And I think that's unfortunate. He's made a lot of money for not really selling a ticket or a pay-per-view unit in the last year. I believe in the last year or so since joining Top Rank, he's made approximately $7 to $8 million. Now, this is for a guy who couldn't even legitimately sell out the Agua Caliente Theater, which takes about 2,000. And I just don't understand it, that I know he's disappointed in not getting the Manny Pacquiao rematch, but Manny Pacquiao did not choose him for a very simple reason. The Marquez fight will do better business and make more money for Manny Pacquiao. With that being said, Tim Bradley has to move on, and he had an opportunity to be in a very interesting, unique promotion in Miami against Lamont Peterson, where I understand he was going to make more money, significantly more money, than what Andre Ward did back in September for beating Chad Dawson. And, yes, see, there's two ways to look at it. Is he taking a significant pay cut from fighting Manny Pacquiao? Of course he is.
Right.
But not every fight at that point is going to be against Manny Pacquiao. I think fighters have to realize one thing. Just because you make a certain amount of money against a certain opponent, that's not a baseline. That doesn't necessarily become your minimum. Every single fight / promotion has an attached value to it. And the money that I've heard that he's making for Peterson, I was astounded by, but he has decided for some other reason to kind of question the deal, and he's going to have to live the consequences. I think fighters have to realize, unless your name is Manny or Floyd or the Klitschko's or maybe even Cotto or Chavez, the boxing world moves on with or without you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's the bottom line. You know, it's an unfortunate situation. Bradley Guerrero, do you think – I don't know if you read Robert Morales' piece today. He was talking about the money that was allocated. Did you hear anything that was going on there?
The numbers that Robert Morales quoted Bob Arum as saying, I've heard from other people, and I've talked to other people and who have told me that the numbers aren't exact, but they're in the ballpark. So Bob Arum is going to get blamed because he's always blamed for everything from the high price of gas to unemployment to certain fights not being made. That's his lot in life. Perhaps he's brought on some of that deservedly. However, Golden Boy has repeatedly said, and Oscar did on Twitter, that we're not taking the Bradley fight. He said this about a month ago, right, on Twitter, that we're not doing a Bradley fight. We'll have a better option. Okay.
Right.
So my question to the management of Robert Guerrero, which would be Louis DeCubis Jr. and Bob Santos, is have you asked Golden Boy, what is it? Where is it? When is it? And how much do we get paid?
You know,
belief is...
What's that?
I was just going to mention, we had Louis DeCubis on, and he keeps saying that we're going to be surprised on that next move. Right, Gabriel? Remember that? He keeps saying, you know, it's going to be big. And I keep thinking, what could be bigger than that right now?
I think there's a very good chance of a Berto fight November 24th, which I like to fight. But I'm just wondering, number one, what's the license fee and how much will Robert Guerrero receive? That's the only question I have for Golden Boy. That's as simple as that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Because it's not more than that other one. And to me, the matchup, and I was surprised that you were surprised on the next round this week. I don't think the matchup's very good. I mean, on paper, he's a better boxer. He's a tricky style. And Berto, you could point to Colato and say he had trouble with the southpaw. But I think it's kind of like Josecito and Canelo. I think Berto is ready to go to 54, and I don't think Guerrero is truly a 47. I think it's physically a mismatch.
Well, Dave, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, but I think Guerrero's style, I agree with you. He's more of a 140-pounder masquerading at 47, and obviously Berto is not itching to move up, but if they're talking about a fight with a big, strong 54-pounder like Cornelius Bundridge, you're right. The size advantage goes to Berto. What I'm saying is I think it's an interesting fight because Guerrero does not really use distance that well and space out the ring with his long reach. I agree with you on that. From what I've been told, if that's the fight that's made, Berto against Guerrero on Thanksgiving weekend, that it will take place in San Jose. Now, how well that draws, I really don't know. But I do find it interesting that I think it's time for HBO, someone at HBO, whoever it is, to actually clear the air and to set the record straight. Who gave an honest effort in trying to make Guerrero Bradley and who did not?
Right.
I think it's that clear because what's going on in this business, we're getting two clear, distinct leagues. And eventually, while you might get fights like Rios Alvarado, which I love, and I cannot wait to watch it in about 48 hours. However, we'll never get the winner of that fight against Lucas Matisse because it's one thing if the two separate factions of Golden Boy and Top Rank do not want to work together. That's understandable. However, when it is state-sponsored by the networks, that is a whole different set of problems.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's at this point the Cold War. I mean, is it nuclear? What is it? Is it firmly embedded in our culture and never going to go away?
We went from Bay of Pigs to now it is kind of a nuclear winter.
Right.
You know, if you look at the schedules, you know, one network is very golden, and I like some of their fights. But there comes a tipping point. Like, Abner Mares and Selmo Moreno is a fight that I like.
Yeah.
I can't wait to be there. I look forward to it. However, I'd like to see the winner of this perhaps fight Nonito Donaire. But right now, those types of discussions, it's pure fantasy. It's a non-starter. You're never going to get it to happen. And I think that's one of the issues that I think the network's going to have to make some clear decisions as we flip to the new year in about 2-3 months.
Which is surprising because they do like to act like promoters. I mean, if they're going to be acting like promoters, then they really need to act on this because they're losing money.
Well, David, when it's all said and done, who's putting up the money for most of these fights? It's the networks. Without the license fee, a lot of these fights do not happen. They have control in terms of quality control and green lighting certain matchups. they nick certain matchups, and they have the economic leverage and the power to say, we don't want A, B, or C, but we'll take D.
Right.
So, you know, my question is, listen, I love Rio Alvarado. It's the fight that I'm looking forward to more than any as we round out this year. It's a very strong schedule. But there's going to come a point in time, and listen, it happened with Manny Pacquiao, that Manny Pacquiao's run out of opponents, and now we're doing Police Academy 7 where they're going to Moscow.
Right.
Listen, the Marquez-Pacquiao rivalry has been very entertaining, but I'm having a certain fatigue. I know it's selling well. I think it'll do very robust numbers. But, guys, you talk to a lot of boxing fans, and they've had enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I really do.
I still, you know, as a guy, that, as a reporter that pays his own expenses, I really am looking at that date going, do I want to go? I've been there for two of them. Do I want to go for three? You know, I don't know. Have you been at all three, Steve?
Yes, I have. I've seen all 36, and it almost feels as though I'm stuck in a bad marriage and there's kids, so you can't separate. So, you know, I might be sleeping on the couch and miserable, but, yeah, I'm going to be there. I mean, Pacquiao events are fun. I like Manny Pacquiao.
That's
and
true.
You never know what could happen. You might end up with a great fight. But the thing that troubles me about that rivalry is that every fight has gotten a little less exciting. And there has been a point of diminishing return. So I'd like to see if both guys or either one of these guys could actually come out of their shell and fight in a little bit more volatile manner. See, that's the beautiful thing about Rio Alvarado. I think there's a certain compatibility with these two individuals that's going to make it a great fight. And by the way, guys, this fight is going to be very successful commercially. I've been told that this will be the highest grossing, most well-attended fight at the Home Depot Center. I think it's going to be a very, very electric night.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait.
What do you think about Danny Garcia's move about getting that rematch with Eric Morales? What do you think about that, Steve?
Well, that, you know, I give Danny Garcia no blame in that. There was a rematch clause. Eric Morales at that point was the draw, and he was the champion with the belt. So it was not him that enforced the rematch. There was a contractual obligation that he had to live up to because Eric Morales decided to take the rematch. However, I don't understand the placement of this event. I do understand that it's a Barclays Center and that it's a grand opening, that Golden Boy has an exclusive deal with that venue. That's all well and fine. But I've always said, if you want to have a successful promotion, you got to have three things. Number one, you have the right fight. You got to have geographic logic in terms of placing it, and then you must have affordable pricing. From what I've been told, and I know this for a fact, that the Barclays Center is running discounts on tickets every single price point. Okay, and to me, when you do that, it's a dangerous, slippery slope because
right.
you are then alienating those who bought tickets. And I got emails and tweets from people saying that they'll never buy another Golden Boy ticket because they feel ripped off. And it's hard to blame them at that point. Second of all, again, Eric Morales is Mexican, and Danny Garcia is from Philadelphia. So, someone please tell me how that makes sense in Brooklyn. And I've been told by very good sources that we're about, what, 8-9 days away from that card.
Yeah.
Less than 3,000 legitimate tickets have been sold for that event.
I think their sense was that, you know what, he's Puerto Rican descent, and he should be able to sell tickets, but without flirting with it in the beginning. They just went gung-ho for it. I can never understand what the minds in Golden Boy, you know. They always say that more minds is better than one, but in this case, these minds are just not working. They're conflicting with each other.
Well, Dave, let me ask you this. When you plant a garden, you have to do a lot of work, and you have to grow it, right?
Right.
To me, if you look at Danny Garcia and you go to his record, how many times has he actually fought in that time zone?
Right.
He hasn't all that much. I think he's had more fights in our part of town than he's had close to New York or Philadelphia. And it goes to show you that with a draw, draws are not like AstroTurf where you can just put it down and you have a football field. If you want to plant real grass, you have to grow it, you have to develop it, it has to be nurtured over a period of time. And right now, that right there is field turf or AstroTurf. It's not grass.
Well, that's the thing. It's the most confusing
it's
placement
not grass.
Ever.
It's crabgrass.
Well, it's like Dawson and Hopkins in Los Angeles. But kind of getting even back to put the possibility of the Berto fight with Guerrero, that date's just right around the corner. And they still haven't figured out all the details of the contract or whatever. They're working it out. It just seems – I wonder if Golden Boy – if they're trying to UFC the thing, I mean, certainly they're doing that with the media, but in terms of their product, that you always know it's going to be an action fight. That's all you know. It doesn't matter who's fighting. If it's Golden Boy, it's action. So we just keep throwing cards at people, and hopefully eventually they get used to the brand. That's the only way I can kind of figure out some of these things.
Yeah, you're right, because their philosophy is don't worry about marinating or developing a big fight, which I don't necessarily always disagree with, you know, but let's look at the facts of Robert Guerrero. And I know that there are people listening to your show, and they're probably not going to like me pointing out this fact. It's not an opinion. The last fight that they did, Dave, you were there ringside.
I was there.
The California Commission reports, they gave away more tickets than they sold. That's it. That's all I have to say about it.
That's the thing. And they're, you know, Schaefer was talking about going to the UK. And I'm kind of thinking, you haven't killed enough markets here? I don't understand. You know, it's kind of a, like you're saying, either you're going to grow something like what Aram did. He, you know, Cowboy Stadium, he's turned that into a venue that you can go back to. Some people kind of complain that it's not as great, it's not as cracked up to be. But still, he's, you know, going back to Yankee Stadium, heading into Miami. I mean, I know Golden Boy's opening a new one with the Barclays. But, you know, and they've got Danny Jacobs. They've got local guys, kind of what I guess Lou does with Sergio Martinez. So you load the undercard with local draws, and but apparently that's not working. So, they're
but
just
again,
so young.
But, Gabe, you go through that whole roster. Danny Jacobs, I think out of his last six or seven fights, Gabe, I think they were all on the West Coast, weren't they? Because I know we were at a couple of them.
Right.
Right? The Pirov fight was in Vegas. His comeback fight, which we were at, was at the Honda Center. So, again, it's not just enough to have guys from a geographic area fight and say he's the prodigal son, the conquering hero who's come back home. You have to actually develop that market, and that is key, and it takes development. It probably means losing money in the beginning. It means making sacrifices, but eventually you will have something. Now, there is an art form to this. It is not just as simple as setting up a lemonade stand and hoping that everyone is thirsty. And it's going to be real interesting, guys, to see how December 1st does, because Miguel Cotto has a very storied history, maybe the most well-drawing, lucrative fighter ever at the Madison Square Garden.
How much money?
How's he going to do on December 1st? That's all I'm asking.
Yeah. I agree. Steve, how much money do you think that Golden Boy has to keep just dishing out? I mean, because the way they handle things, it to me, it just spells for an automatic fold-up.
You know, you have to understand, though, when you do shows on Showtime or HBO, I know that there's expenses in terms of marketing costs, promotional expenditures, but most of that money is footed by the network. It's on their dime. So theoretically, when you have a network who's willing to give you an X amount of dates or give their whole network to you, how much money are you really putting up? The only time in this modern business model where you are really putting up your own risk as it relates to TV is pay-per-view. Okay, pay-per-view is the most honest, effective way and the most realistic way of determining a guy's value, because it's not about Andre Berto selling 50 seats but still getting paid $1 million. When you do pay-per-view, how much you sell and how much revenue you derive, that is your real value. And I've always said there's two values in boxing. There's the real value that is determined by stuff like your live gate with the variable of your television rating and then, of course, your pay-per-view revenue that you derive. There's the other one, which is just fantasy land, where they decide to give you a lot of money because you're with Al Heyman.
Right.
Yeah.
Can't argue that.
Yet another problem within the sport of boxing. Well, Steve, thanks again as always coming by. And what else are you working on? You have any news and notes you want to throw out?
Yeah, well, guys, this fight, I guess, has finally found a home and a venue. November 17th, the same day HBO is doing a fight with Adrian Broner at Atlantic City. Gabe, I'll be scooping you up because we're going to the L.A. Sports Arena. We'll be seeing the ghost of Danny Manning and Mark Jackson and Michael Olowokandi. We're actually going to the Sports Arena. The press conference was today. They formally announced it. A very good little fight between Brian Viloria and Hernan Tyson Marquez and Roman Gonzalez, one of the great little fighters in the world today. And, again, I'm going to write an article on this next week. Why isn't Boxing After Dark picking up these type of fights where this series, the genesis of it from Lou Davila, was fighters like this? Instead, it'll be on Wealth TV and Univision. Also, Aram told me yesterday that Manny Pacquiao has signed a contract extension that will extend to the end of 2014. So, in essence, I think it just might be a lifetime contract at this point. And if Tim Bradley does not go December 15th, his wish is to talk to Top Rank, to HBO. And I know he met with some executives today at the Fight Hotel that he would like to still go to Miami. I don't know if it's going to be the ballpark, but he would like to feature Guillermo Rigondo and the return of Yuriarkis Gamboa as a Boxing After Dark show.
Nice. Well, there you go. Yep. Steve Kim doing it like a few others. Actually, no others. Unless you wait about 10 minutes and Dan Raphael will put out his notebook.
Oh, I got no comment from my fight game colleague there. None at all, guys.
Nice job on there, by the way. I was a little thrown when I saw you in the suit. I was expecting to see,
the
I Love East L.A. shirt.
And by the way, I do want to make it clear, because people are still emailing me with a very serious question. Yes, I was wearing pants, and yes, I was wearing dress shoes. I just want to get that clear right off the bat, once and for all.
Oh, wow.
I appreciate that. Well, Steve, I'll see you this weekend at the fights. Scoop me up for you'll see the Canes game, and then see some violence down at the Home Depot Center. How lucky are we, man? This is, Rios Antione, Marquez Vasquez 3, Williams Margarito, and now this fight. This could be special. There's something about that venue.
Absolutely. Home Depot Center is one of my favorite little venues. I only wish it had a retractable roof so that we could do this 12 months out of the year. And check the weather. Weather's going to be very mild. Bring a sweater. It's going to be a fun night. And the one thing I do like about boxing that has happened recently, a trend, if you look at most of our shows at that HBO Showtime level, I think this is, and I'd have to really check this out, but I think this is the lowest percentage of fights that we've had at casinos in a very long time. So local fans in Southern California, L.A., San Jose, in those areas, Brooklyn, they can actually go out and see the fight. The second step that has to happen is certain factions have to be more realistic in terms of what they are pricing the tickets at. But I cannot wait this weekend, Gabe. I'll see you then. And Dave, as always, man, great to speak to you.
Hey, brother, thanks to you. Same here.
All right, thanks a lot, guys. You have a great night.
All right, man. Take care.
Steve Kim on Leaving the Ring. If you missed it's his report, actually. Not really an interview. It's more of a report when Steve Kim comes on here, man. If you missed it, be sure to tune back in. Catch us on iTunes, or you just get on the website, leavingtheringradio.com, and listen to all the interviews we had today, man. We had some really I'm having a blast. I just had a blast right now with Steve. Honor just dropping some knowledge and dropping some exclusive news here on Leaving the Ring.
Yeah. Dude, that L.A. Sports Arena, I can't wait, because I was kind of bummed there was going to be a Golden Boy show there, and I'm not going to be able to go to that one. But now I get to go to a show, so I'm really excited. And that fight, Tyson Marquez and Valoria, unbelievable, dude. That's going to be a killer little battle.
It is. I keep saying I got to make it up there. I just, with work killing me and putting the pressure on.
You got to move here.
I know. Just got to suck it up and say, you know what? I'm just going to move down over there because I got to move all the good stuff.
I got to win the lottery and just, I'll put you up in a nice apartment. take you out on the weekend. It'll be nice.
I can settle for the couch. It's no biggie. Anyways, we're going to be doing our fight schedule here on Leaving the Ring Radio. Gabe Montoya will be pulling that up. And fight fans, you want to call in really quick, you certainly can. Let's talk some boxing here on Leaving the Ring. I think we pretty much have covered everything. Where does Linares go from his win from last Saturday night? I tell you what, I don't know really for sure. I've got a lot of emails about that, what my thoughts about Linares' win. And, it just tells me he does great against guys that when he's on his game, he's on his game. It's just a step up. Thompson obviously hasn't. We haven't seen much of him. Haven't heard about him. I did hear that he does have a fight. Who is the conqueror of Linares? Who did stop a rematch? He was the interruption to a rematch with DeMarco. But does Linares get a shot at DeMarco? I don't know. It all depends on how he looks and what he does against Broner. So there's some options out there for Linares. I just not really quite sure what those options are at this moment. I think it's a great move of him going back to Venezuela. I mean, not Venezuela, going back to Japan with Tekken, his promoter. Maybe refocus him, maybe get him back in gear. I thought it was great for it to see him get rounds in, but he did get touched. He was getting touched. And to me, that's just it's one of those things he's still got to go back to the drawing board. You know, you're always going to get touched in boxing, but he was touched a lot. I don't know what your thoughts about that fight, Gabriel, but I thought he was getting touched a little too much, and he's still there. I still see those flaws.
If he gets touched, he just – I mean, the guy starts swelling as he walks into the ring. You know,
yeah.
He's that guy. What can you say? I mean, he's got beautiful offense. You know, I mean, long range, mid range, he's all good. It's the inside he has some trouble with. You know, I think guys, the book's out on him. If you can attack that front side and get inside, boom, you know, you start just whacking away with that hook. Good things can happen. You can cut him. He'll swell up. Maybe you can even knock him out. I thought he was in more control. Early on, things were pretty rough for him. But I thought as the fight went on, to me, he felt, even though he was getting touched, I think everybody kind of overreacts. We overreacted to how good we thought he was going to be, so that now when he gets hit at all, we're like, oh, this guy's horrible. I think he's just an action fighter. He's a regular guy that doesn't have a lot of power, but is technically kind of great. He's like almost like Jose Navarro if Navarro swelled up a lot, you know, and got knocked out, which he, you know, he had a very good chin. He actually trains privately. He trains dudes over at Fortune Gym. That guy, you want to talk about technique, you can always tell the people he's taught because they all have great footwork and they all have, like, really nice punches. But with Linares, I think that's he's going to be – he is who he is. He's a guy with not much power. Maybe as he moves up, you know, he gets a little bit physically stronger. But it's almost like Cintron after Margarito. People are always going to go after him. They're always going to pressure him because the book's out on him. You can
exactly.
Stop him.
You can stop him. You can cut him. You can make him bleed, and you can get that possible stoppage. Whether or not you're a big puncher, you still have the odds with you because of the fact Linares' face doesn't hold up.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. You know, I thought the Kamagai fight. I thought Kamagai won. I was really disappointed in the fact that they called it a draw because I thought that he was landing. Not always the harder punches, but I think down the stretch, particularly the back end of the fight, I thought that he took control and did well. But what an action fight. And the people that I talked to that were excited to see the Memorial Auditorium, I was talking to Doug Fisher about it at the media day. It's just a great venue, man. People loved it. You know, Sacramento in general, that's a cool little town. That whole area downtown is pretty sweet. Go see some fights, and you got like the Torch Club next door where they got great blues. That's really the spot, man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get with that fight schedule.
All right, I'm ready. October 12th, Friday, 2012, at the Ameristar Casino in St. Charles, Missouri. Showtime's Showbox, Jonathan Cepeda, 12-0 versus Lamar Russ, 10-0. And I'm starving, so I'm not making fight picks on these. Jose Pizarreza, 10-0 versus Alan Benavides, 7-1. In support there, which is bizarre, the third fight underneath, Jermaine Taylor, 34-1 versus Raul Munoz, 22-15-1. At the Bell Center.
Munoz. Doesn't that name ring a bell? Wasn't that the same Raul Munoz? No, it wasn't. My bad. Keep going, because I know you're hungry.
I'm starving.
No, wait. No, go ahead. I'm serious.
Montreal, Canada. On Wealth TV, I must not be able to afford this. Adonis Stevenson, 18-1 versus Donovan George, 23-2-1. It's actually a really good fight. I think
that is a fight. Now, you know what? We didn't even get a chance to talk about that. But who do you got on that one?
I'm going to Donna Stevenson, but I think Don George has a really good chance to win. I think he kind of froze up against Rodriguez and didn't let him go until late. And I think against Stevenson, while it'd be dangerous to do that, I think he's got a good shot at getting into the fight if he does that, if he starts that way, strong.
I agree with you. You know, styles make fights. I don't know if I'm gonna count out Donovan right now. I think that he has a very solid chance of beating Stevenson. Stevenson obviously is a little bit more quicker, but I don't know. I like Donovan's his steadiness. I think that he has the tools to make the Canadians go, oh my God. So I'm gonna go. I'm gonna go with Donovan, man. I think that he can do it.
Stevenson, you know, he's got that one punch knockout power. So I mean, we're gonna kind of find out. I think it's real. We're gonna see how real it is, and if Don George can adjust and get close. To start putting some hands on him. I think it's a hell of a fight. Underneath that is David Lemieux, 26-2, versus Alvaro Gona, 11-1. be interesting to see where Lemieux is at this point.
Yeah, glad to see him get back into the ring.
Yeah, I just hope he's prepared himself accordingly. Kevin Bazier, 17-0 versus Patrick Litkowitz, 6-0. That's all the guys that will be shown. At the Sport Hall, Hamburg, Germany, Dennis Boitsev, 31-0 versus Konstantin Attic, 23-7-2. And moving right along to Saturday night. Actually, Matthew Hatton at the Bowlers Exhibition Center in Manchester, England, 42-6-2 versus Michael Lomax, 18-4-1. And I'm starving. October 13th, Saturday in 2012 at the Home Depot Center in Carson, California on HBO World Championship Boxing. Nonito Donaire, 29-1 versus Toshiaki Nishioka, 39-4-3 for the Ring Magazine World Featherweight Championship. They're also throwing in the IBF and WBO Junior Featherweight belts into the mix. Dave, I'm going with Nonito Donaire by unanimous decision or late stoppage. I think Nishioka's legs are tired. I know he's focused, and that makes him a very dangerous man. I don't think he's going to be overtrained. It's going to be something of a battle and much more exciting than we realize. It'll be like tense early on. A fight's going to break out in the middle, and it's going to have a nice roar down to the finish.
I think this is by far going to be the best fight and best challenging fight for Nonito Donaire. I think, if anything, if he's not up to game, he's not up to changing or making adjustments, there's a strong possibility that he might be at the short end of the stick. But I'm going to go with you. I think that he has a strong possibility of stopping, of getting the stoppage and giving the fight fans what he's wanted to give them for some time, which is a great KO stoppage.
Yeah, I think he can do it. It could end up even being like a TKO off a cut. I mean, being up close, I was like right up close to Nishioka. He's got a lot of scar tissue, particularly around that right eye. But there's a nice former slice by the left eye as well that's more of a vertical cut than a horizontal.
Right.
That's a problem.
And to make a note really quick, even though Nishioka has been training, he's been focused for a whole year for Nonito, there's still no way of getting the proper sparring for a guy that has that type of speed and that type of gift.
You know what's interesting is he said, I don't consider him unorthodox or very hard to figure out. We're going to see if he's right on Saturday.
He's absolutely right. He's not very hard to figure out. But the way Steve Kim had put it, he's like a Roy Jones. You know, they're not hard to figure out. They're just really hard to time.
That's true. Look, Dave, I'm starving. Brandon Rios, incident support, 30-0-1. No, you know what? I'm not going to flip back over. I just don't think Nishioka's legs can do it, Dave. I mean, maybe a technical guy right down the middle, because Donaire doesn't use the jab all that often. And sometimes he kind of squares up. And if you – like, you know what I was watching this week was Barrera Hamed. Mm-hmm. And it's a similar fight, don't you think?
I don't know. Barrera Hamed. I don't know.
Hamed obviously didn't train all that good.
Right.
He didn't get as serious. Like, you just look at his body. He looked like shit. I don't think Donaire did that. But it's a guy training himself, not willing to understand the technical parts of the – well, I mean, Nonito does. He just doesn't mind them all the time. Maybe he does in this fight because of what he's faced with. I don't know.
I don't know. If I had to make any type of comparisons of what kind of fight this would look like, I would have to go with Tarver and Roy Jones the first time. You know, where, you know, I honestly don't think Nonito's going to look that fantastic, but I think he will get the stoppage where Roy couldn't do it with Tarver, but where Tarver did enough to mark up Roy Jones Jr., you know, and made it look like he was winning. I mean, obviously, I thought he was winning that fight, but I think with Nonito Donaire, he's going to be marked up. He's going to be tested. He's going to be challenged. But I think at the end of the day, his skill level and his power is what's going to get him out of that rock in a hard place.
Yeah. Speaking of hungry, Brandon Rios, 30-0-1 versus Mike Alvarado, 33-0. That's what's going to come down to in this fight, man. It's who wants it more, who's hungrier, who protects himself just a little bit more than the other guy, because this could be a war of attrition. I don't think there's any question about that. I'm going Mike Alvarado, and I'm going bold. I'm going late stoppage.
I'm going to go mid-round stoppage and stuff. I'm not sure.
That's even more bold.
I'm really, honestly, I think this is the biggest guy he's ever going to face. I think that weight going, fluctuating his weight that he has done, I think it's really taken its toll. We've seen it, you know, and I think we're going to see the evidence of it even more Saturday night. I think we're going to have a great fight. I think Rios is not going to go out like no punk. He's going to stand. He's going to trade. He's going to look for a war. But with the fluctuation of weight, it's your muscle. We saw that with Ted Dawson. You a bit, you know, and I don't know if it's gonna add anything to him to make his legs a little bit more sturdier, but we're obviously gonna find out what his chin is gonna stand against a big 140 pounder Mike Mile High Alvarado. So I'm gonna go with mid stoppage for Mike Mile High Alvarado. I think he stops Brandon Rios in a great, sensational, Ward Gotti like type of fight.
Yeah, I can't wait, dude. It's gonna be ridiculous. And then underneath that, it's Jose Benavidez, 16-0, versus Pavel Miranda, 17-7-1. Jose Roman, 14-0, versus Javier Garcia. I really want to see this fight, 18-2-1. Jose Roman is a really nice young fighter. Evgeny Gradovic, 13-0, versus Jose Barranza, 35-24-2. At the Echo Arena in Liverpool, England, David Price, 13-0, a gigantic heavyweight. It's like 6'8",
yep.
83-inch reach, versus Audley Harrison, 28-5, and what will be no doubt probably his net. He'll keep fighting after.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to keep hearing Audley Harris, you know.
Yeah.
New nickname should be, I'm never going to go away.
Yeah, not fade away Harrison. I think David Price just gets him out of there really fast. At the Coliseo, Amelbert in Yuncos, Puerto Rico, Telefutura, Jeffrey Fontanez, 8-0 versus John Nader, 11-3. In support, Braulio Santos, 7-0 versus John Molina, not that one, 32-20-3. And James DeGale at the Glow Arena in Greenhithe, England, takes on, he's 12-1 versus Hadala Mahumadi, 13-2-1. And at the El Polidro in Caracas, Venezuela, this is an interesting one. Juan Cabrera, 19-0 versus Jadon Codrington. Remember him, 20-3, gone in 18 seconds, Codrington. And there's also a kid, Galahad, fighting at the Glow Arena. It's kind of a trip. 12-0 versus the dreaded TBA. And that is your weekend fight schedule.
Well, there you go. I hope everybody enjoyed this segment of Leaving the Ring. Be sure to catch the Boxing Fix every Sunday night at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 o'clock Eastern, and on Monday nights for the Spanish speaking listeners here that we have on Leaving the Ring. Make sure you catch Noche de Boxeo, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Again, brother, hey, take care of people out there. Don't drink and drive. Have a safe Friday and Saturday night. Enjoy yourself, Gabriel. Enjoy yourself there out there at the Fights at the Home Depot Center, and just make sure to wave at us at the camera when they do that little swing by, you know, that quick swing by the press row.
I'll be doing the wave. You like jumping up and down
by yourself? All right. All right. Well, there you go, man. Everybody have a good night. Gabe, go get something to eat.
Yeah, I'm just dude. Well, I had to make weight, you know, for the 13th, but then you know they told me it's not gonna happen.
Exactly.
As always, fun show. Peace.
Peace out.